Don't Drop the Coffin by Barry Albin Dyer. Read by Mike Grady. I did my first removal at the age of 8, that of an elderly gentleman with a thin moustache in St James Road. My dad told me that carrying a coffin had to be done in a certain dignified way, explaining that the bearers were split into footmen, headmen, and those who will fit anywhere. One of the first golden rules he drilled into me was, whatever you do, don't drop the coffin. You can hit the floor, but the coffin must never. On one occasion at a house in Hamilton Square, when he was coming down the stairs, the coffin slipped and he put his hand out to stop it hitting the wall, damaging his fingers in the process. Despite the pain and the blood dripping from his glove, he still drove the hearse to the cemetery. He protected the coffin. I've never forgotten that. F.A. Albins have been involved in funerals in Bermondsey, southeast London, since the late 18th century, when I believe they were wardens of a cemetery. They are one of Britain's oldest independent firms of funeral directors. When I was very young, Albins had 4 funeral shops, as they were known then, in Bermondsey, Lewisham, Downham and Leytonstone. My dad was the senior manager. Fred, Ernie and Arthur Albin were the joint owners. I often say to people that I was conceived a funeral director. I was born at Guy's Hospital, next to London Bridge Station, on the 2nd of February 1951. Even though my family name was Dyer, at school I was always known as Barry from Albins. Many people assumed my dad was Fred Albin's brother, and consequently I was the young Albin. When I purchased F.A. Albin & Sons in 1986, I decided to use the name Albin as a way of maintaining a continuity with the Albin family. Fred was like a father to me anyway. It's not that I'm not proud of being a Dyer. I am. Dyer, though, isn't perhaps the best name for a funeral director. My sons, Simon and Jonathan, who have followed me into the business, call themselves Albin Dyer, because people have also called them Albin. Calling myself Barry Albin is a bit like using a stage name. Increasingly nowadays, I call myself Barry Albin Dyer, but I consider myself a bloodline funeral director because the Dyers, distant members of my dad's family, were funeral directors in East London. During my childhood, Bermondsey and its neighbour Rotherhithe were a bustling docks area, recovering from being severely bombed during the Second World War. Ships from all over the world would sail up the Thames, bringing wood, sugar, spices, bananas, ivory and all manner of products, which would then be unloaded, stored in the wharves and eventually transported across Britain. Many of the families had some sort of connection with the docks, as did my granddad. I've lived most of my life in Bermondsey and Rotherhithe. My first home was in Weston Street, a few doors from Albin's garage. When I was 5, we moved to Tranton Road, where we lived above the Chapel of Rest in a former dairy. Later, we lived above the F.A. Albin & Sons shop at 62 Jamaica Road. Then, after I was married, I lived with my wife and sons in the flat above our present Culling Road funeral home. Today, I live in a house by the river in Rotherhithe. My most vivid memories of the funeral business are derived from the shop on Jamaica Road. On the wall at the rear of the shop, facing the London Bridge to Kent railway line, were the words F.A. Albin & Sons, Funeral Directors, Burials and Cremations, Embalming Available, written in black letters on a white background. I was frightened of death in those early days, and my friends at school wouldn't come around to play with me because I lived in a funeral home. I admit there were times when I was very lonely, especially as I was an only child. When I went to see my nan at her flat by the Bricklayer's Arms, she would pull a face and say, "Barry, give me your clothes, I can smell death on you." This, I have learnt since, was due to the smell of timber and French polish on my clothes. On the other hand, there is also a taste of death. This happens when you inhale a lot of the gas of a deceased person. At the age of 9, I was given a summer holiday job at Albin's. I'd clean the cars, learn how to make stillborn baby coffins in the workshop, put the mouldings on adult coffins, and French polish them with linseed oil. The final polishing was done in the front of the shop, in full view of the customers. I'd be there in my apron, polishing away. There was a magical old glove that must have been with the firm from the earliest days. It was rock hard. French polishing was very difficult. If I made a mistake with the final brushing, I would have to wait for it to dry, then sand it off and start again. As a teenager, I had toyed with the idea of being a photographer, policeman, and professional footballer. I played for Crystal Palace Schoolboys and later went on to play at non-league level. But I don't think there was ever any doubt that I would end up working for Albin's. The moment when I knew I wanted to be a funeral director came when, in the middle of the night, I went with my dad to the mortuary at Guy's Hospital to collect a deceased man and take him to Moorfields Eye Hospital. His eyes were to be used to help give someone else sight. We were given a police escort from Guy's. It was incredibly exciting and dramatic, speeding through the traffic, and it felt like we were on a life-and-death mission. And this was when I discovered my vocation. When I left school and started working full-time for Albin's, my first job in the morning was to polish the brass on the front of the shop door. I would also make buttons, small round pieces of oak that covered the screws in the side of the coffin. As a child, I used to sit on a board and put little nails into the buttons, which were then polished before being tapped into the coffin. Because of the tedious nature of the work, I used to pretend they were soldiers and have battles with them. There would always be a smell of linseed oil from the coffins. I used to hate having to carry the timber that we used to make the coffins, not because of the heavy lifting involved, but because of the stag beetles that I would often find. My dad and Ernie Albin would give me 1 and 6 pence a week for these jobs. From an early age, I developed a knack for laying deceased people out. I learned how to apply makeup and do their hair. I also learned that the round wrappers from inside a box of chocolates could be used to support the eyes of a deceased person and prevent them from sinking. And when, in the early 1970s, Albin's bought Knox's, another Bermondsey funeral firm, Mrs. Knox always insisted that I lay the bodies out. When a client came in to book a funeral, it would be done in the tiny office. On the floor of the office was a rug. After the family had left, I would be called in, the rug pulled back, a little trap door lifted up, and I would be lowered down into the dark cellar below, where the coffins that were three-quarters finished were standing. I would have to take one of the coffins and push it up through the hole for it to be French polished. If someone came in while I was down below, the trap door would be closed and the rug pulled back over the hole, and I would have to wait for the family to go. But sometimes Dad and Fred would forget I was down there. When this happened, I had to find my way through the darkness of the cellar and up the stairs to a locked door, which had coffins stacked in front of it. I would then bang loudly on it until someone heard me. When I was 19, I conducted my first funeral, that of a little girl in Brixton. Having acted as a bearer and a driver on numerous funerals, Fred felt I was now ready to take the lead role. I was thrilled. In those days, Fred and Ernie Albin set the rules for a funeral. When people came into the shop and said, "We've lost Mum," they would be told, "The funeral will be next Wednesday. We'll meet at 8 a.m. at your house, and the service will be at so-and-so church at 9 a.m. The families were grateful and would reply, "Thank you, Mr. Albin." They just accepted that the funeral director, like the doctor and the priest, knew best. When Tuesday morning came, my excitement was tinged with nervousness. Fred went over the various tasks that I had to do. Not that he needed to, though, as I had watched him conducting funerals on countless occasions. He took his well-thumbed A to Z and ran his finger over the route. We carried the small coffin out of the chapel of rest and placed it in the hearse. Just as I was about to leave, Fred said, "If you have any problems, phone your dad in the office. Oh, and by the way, the family are West Indian." This was 1970, and Bermondsey was quite a closed community, with many people living and dying there without ever having left its boundaries. I had little experience of other cultures, apart from an Indian man in a turban who used to come round selling ties out of a suitcase. The only West Indians I had met had been bus conductors, hospital porters, and nurses. I wasn't sure what to expect. Little did I know that I was about to be taught one of the most important lessons I was ever to learn as a funeral director, and as a human being. We arrived at the house in a smart street of semis off Brixton Hill at 12:55 p.m, 5 minutes early. We had been booked into the chapel at Streatham Park Cemetery at 1:45 p.m. I noticed a phone box across the street, but I didn't think I would need to phone Dad. Getting out of the car and walking up the path, I felt very proud to be the person in charge of the funeral. Dad told me that when I arrived at the house, I was to go in and take the family straight to the cemetery for the service, bury the child, and then return to the funeral home. "Hello, I'm Barry from Albin's," I said to the man who answered the door. "Are you Sophie's father?" He nodded. "Do you have any floral tributes before we leave for the cemetery?" I asked. From inside of the house I could hear the sound of mournful gospel music, and a smell of food filled the air. "I have just one flower," he replied. "Bring my daughter in, please." "I'm sorry, I can't," I told him apologetically. "My dad says we're not allowed to." "Bring the child in. We are waiting," said the father, pointing to the hearse. "I'll have to phone my dad and see what he says. That's not part of the arrangement. Excuse me a moment." I walked briskly down the path and hurried across the street. The men with me were wondering what the problem was. I waved my hands to signal that everything was fine. I fumbled for some change and dialed the office. "Dad, the family want me to bring the child in. What do I do?"
"Never mind that, son. You just tell them that you have to go straight to the cemetery. They'll be fine."
"Okay, Dad," I said, not entirely convinced, having seen the determination on the father's face. "My dad says that we have to go straight to the cemetery," I explained, when I returned to the house.
"No, bring our child into the house. We're not going to the cemetery until you do that," said the father emphatically.
"I'm sorry, but I can't. My dad says..."
"Bring the child in."
He was starting to look angry. I stood there not knowing what to do and feeling a little bit frightened of the responsibility on my shoulders. There was no way I was going to fail at conducting my first funeral. Fred and Dad had put their faith in me, yet the family were grieving, and I didn't want to make matters worse for them. But how could I resolve the situation? "I'm sorry, I'll have to phone my dad again." He didn't look pleased and went back inside the house. I explained to the men what the delay was and ran across the road to the phone box. "Dad, the family won't have it. They say I have to take the child in or they won't leave for the cemetery." My dad paused, then said,
"Very well, take the child in."
Relieved, I ran back to the house. The father brightened when I told him that my dad agreed.
"Good, I'll bring the coffin in then."
"Oh, no, you can't do that. We have to do that."
He scowled at me and repeated, "I'll bring the coffin in."
I didn't want to get into another argument with him, nor did I want to go and phone my dad again. So I told him I would help him carry the coffin into the house. I was anxious about being late at the cemetery. It was now 1:20 p.m. The father placed the coffin on a table in the front room, which was full of mourners eating and drinking. Then he told me he wanted to undo the lid, and that they wouldn't leave for the cemetery unless they could see the child's face. I didn't know what to do. It seemed a reasonable request, so I went back to the phone box. This time Fred picked up the phone.
"All right, son, calm down. Let them take the lid off then, but on no account are they to touch the child. That's unheard of."
I went to the hearse and took the old wooden screwdriver out of the glove compartment and returned to the house. As I unfastened the lid and took it off, the family backed away, screaming. Then, to my amazement, they came back over to the coffin and began singing to the child. I stood there taking it all in, thinking that this was marvellous. The father placed some toys, an apple and a coconut into the coffin, then motioned me to screw the lid back on and said they were ready to leave. The mourners filed out of the house, and then I led the bearers down the path. I checked my watch as we drove through the cemetery gates. It was just after 1:45 p.m. Hopefully the superintendent wouldn't be awkward and tell us that we had to wait. He came out of his office making tut-tut sounds and pointing to his watch. "Are we okay?" I asked.
"Are you conducting, young man?"
he asked in a patronizing tone.
"Yes. It's my first time."
"I see. Well, Fred and your dad will have told you never to be late at a cemetery, I'm sure of that."
"They have. It's just that we had a few problems at the family's house."
"All right. Off you go."
Following the short service in the chapel, we drove over to the grave at the far end of the cemetery. As we were lowering the coffin and the minister was reciting the prayers, the father said that he and his family were going to fill the grave in.
"You can't do that.
That's our job, I said. After some negotiation, two men picked up the shovels and began filling in the grave. By now I realized it was futile to say anything. This was the way they wanted the funeral to be. What right had I to tell them they were wrong? I could see that while Fred and Dad were excellent in the way they conducted a funeral, professional, dignified, caring, they were doing it in accordance with their tradition. I saw for the first time that in the future, some traditions would need to be changed, and that a funeral director had to be more flexible. When I arrived back at the shop and told my dad and Fred about the funeral, and how I felt it was right that the family's wishes should take precedence, Fred shook his head.
You're making a rod for your own back, Barry, believe me.
But as I went upstairs, I heard Fred say to my dad, George, he's learnt a lot today, and we should be proud of him. Fred was right in one way. Allowing the family to have a say in the way a funeral is conducted does make life more difficult. But I could see that by inviting them to make decisions over the kind of funeral they wanted for their loved one, the day would be that extra bit special, and those present would remember it for many years to come. From that point on, the way Albin's conducted funerals began to change, because times were changing, and my philosophy as a funeral director was formed. The 1,000 or so families who each year book Albin's to conduct their funerals are offered what you might call a comprehensive menu of services. Funerals today are about consumer choice. We provide five types of funeral. Disposal, which is exactly what it says, and doesn't include limousines or a religious service. Practical, where we make all the arrangements. Ecological, with a cardboard coffin. Budget, with a hearse and one car and covered by the DSS. And tailor-made, where you can have as many cars and additional services as you want. As a funeral director, my job has many dimensions. I'm part counsellor, priest, doctor, lawyer, social worker, policeman, financial consultant, master of ceremonies, actor, chauffeur, travel agent, makeup artist, mechanic, removal man, diplomat, courier, flower arranger, salesman, choreographer, DJ, private investigator, linguist, photographer, fashion consultant, historian, navigator, excavator, clairvoyant, and, occasionally, bouncer. What's more, caring for a deceased person and planning a funeral with their family is a very complex and personal business, with little room for error, and one that has to operate within a legal framework. The funeral director is at the centre of a network of professional relationships that might include doctors, nurses, morticians, coroners, pathologists, police, social workers, bereavement counsellors, the fire brigade, customs and excise, airlines, registrars, solicitors, bank managers, priests, vicars, ministers, pastors, imams, and other religious figures, cemetery superintendents and gravediggers. Not forgetting the companies that supply everything from embalming fluid to coffin handles. How far consumer choice has affected the funeral industry can be gleaned from an unexpected phone call I took one evening. Please forgive the language, but the caller was a rather colourful character.
Hello. Albin, said the voice at the other end of the phone.
Yes, I answered.
Bell?
Asked the voice.
That's right. Lovely. No, you don't know me, but Atsy's told me to ring you.
What, Mickey the Hat?
That's him. He said you buried his brother, who got murdered a few months back, and he said you're the dog's bollocks, mate.
Oh, that's nice, I said, recalling how Mickey the Hat's brother had died after being savagely attacked outside a South London restaurant one night. So, what's up?
Now, my old man was the governor, an eye tie, and he's just died. Now, I want the horses. Have you got the horses, Bell?
Yes, I've got my own horses, I replied, named George and Fred after my dad and uncle.
Oh, fucking handsome. And the carriage?
Yes, it was built in 1864 and used for the funeral of the first president of Ireland.
Fucking hell, perfect. Right, now, I want six cars. I bought a big mausoleum for the old man, me, mum and the old woman. It's down at Streatham. I want a zinc-lined coffin.
I'll have to stop you there. He'll need a lead shell and oak case, just like I've made for the royal family. It will have to be 2 inches thick, dovetailed and jointed, because you don't want it coming apart, I explained.
What? You mean like the Queen?
Fucking hell, you're the fucking governor. Now, how much?
I'll need a few minutes to work it out. Do you want Dad embalmed? I think you should. Unlike some funeral directors I know, I always give people the choice whether or not to have a deceased person embalmed.
Yeah.
And you want a mass?
Yeah, spot on.
Where are we going? The Italian church in Stockwell?
What? Do you know it?
Of course I do. This is my game.
So that's what I want. Now, the old woman. She got to do all the running around. So, how much?
After a quick calculation, I said,
about £4,100. For one? Fucking handsome. But can the old woman see the coffin? So that she's happy.
I told him the coffins we used for mausoleums were imported from Italy.
Where does your dad come from?
He comes from, not far from Milan.
Well, that's funny, because our coffins are made in Peschiera del Garda, which is about 100 kilometres northeast of Milan.
There was a pause.
You're fucking having me on. Fucking hell.
Then he called to someone in the background.
The fucking bloke here, he got it dead right. You won't believe it.
Then the phone suddenly cut out. After a few seconds, it rang again.
Sorry, pal. I shouldn't be using this, he said.
Well, phone me on the landline, I replied, thinking he was possibly on a mobile phone.
I can't.
Why?
I'm in the fucking nick, ain't I?
This was a first. I don't think I'd ever had a funeral booking from inside a prison.
I see, I said. They'll let me out for the funeral, but only for 6 hours.
Well, in that case, I'll write a letter to the governor, and I'll explain that you're genuinely going to the funeral, and that I'm a magistrate and will be responsible for you.
What? You're a magistrate?
I smiled to myself. Yes.
Fucking hell. And you're one of us?
Not exactly, I replied, thinking I wasn't sure what one of us was. But you've got to be straight, I warned. Don't go and drop me in it by doing a runner. This is your dad's funeral, and you have to show respect.
Don't worry, Bell. Here, you're a fucking diamond. Fucking diamond geezer. So when are we having it, then?
Why don't you have it on a Saturday morning? I suggested.
What? I can have it on a Saturday morning?
Yes. And then maybe you can get a weekend pass. Maybe. And be with Mum.
Oh, I didn't fucking think of that,
he said excitedly, and then called to someone,
here! Here, he's going to do me a fucking Saturday funeral for me old man!
An hour later, his wife telephoned me, worried about all the running around she would have to do.
My husband said he'll give you £5,000 if you'll come over to me. He said he wants the best funeral ever.
I told her that it would be the best ever funeral at £4,100, and I would come and see her anyway.
No,
she insisted.
He says you have to take £5,000, and he won't hear otherwise.
I didn't argue, deciding that I would give the extra money to the Albin Dyer Bermondsey and Rotherhithe Foundation, a charity I set up for local people in need. This story illustrates perfectly what I have strived to achieve in my 40 years as a funeral director. To offer people the kind of funeral they want, and one that will live on in the memory of those present for years to come. In other words, I want to give a bereaved family the best funeral they could imagine, however small or large. During and immediately after the Second World War, funerals were, by and large, small affairs. This was still a time of tightening your belt and low expectations. But the rise in the standard of living in the 1960s, when people started to have central heating, bathrooms, cars, TVs, etc., changed the way people thought about life and broadened their expectations. They found excuses to celebrate family occasions again. And, of course, the death of someone is a major family event. The bigger the funeral, the longer the memory. That is the usual thinking. Some of the more unusual funerals I've conducted have included one for a biker, with a flotilla of Harley-Davidsons, and one for an Italian ice cream salesman, the Tony Bell Man, with about 50 ice cream vans. I've conducted several for firemen, where the coffin was carried on a fire engine, and I've done gypsy funerals, where the mourners have been in carriages pulled by shire horses. After the funeral, everyone went back to the caravan where the person lived and set light to it. When a young woman died after taking ecstasy tablets, I conducted a Gothic-style funeral. The coffin was black and adorned with gold braid. At the funeral of Daisy, the Pearly Queen, all the pearly kings and queens sang and danced around the grave, with the smell of woodbines hanging in the air. The funeral of a Bermondsey woman named Dolly was another jolly affair. The family asked for white horses and booked a jazz band. Mourners were tapping their feet and singing When the Saints Go Marching In and Hello, Dolly. On the other hand, the funeral at St. James's Palace of the Queen Mother's butler was a much more solemn occasion. When the 12th Duke of Argyll died in a London hospital in 2001, we were asked to transport his remains to Inverary Castle, Argyllshire, and, working with Jonathan Harvey, a highly respected Glasgow funeral director, organised the funeral. After a service in the parish church, attended by bagpipers and soldiers in full regalia, the Duke was taken on a boat to a small island for a private burial. So what's the biggest funeral I've ever conducted? Well, while I have conducted the funeral of a former Prime Minister of Pakistan, which included 47 Rolls-Royces in the cortege, and was accompanied by police outriders, and I have led several thousand mourners through central London to the mosque in Penzance Gardens, the answer has to be that of the son of Mr. Jafari, a wealthy Iranian, in 1974. The Iranian embassy gave me the phone number of a Mr. Sabar, who was representing the family. When I phoned the number, I discovered it was the Carlton Towers Hotel, a very expensive place in Knightsbridge. Eventually, a terse-sounding voice came on the line. Mr. Sabar, it's Barry Albin from F.A. Albin. I'm phoning about the funeral arrangements, I said. Yes, meet me in the lobby at the Carlton Towers Hotel at 11 a.m. sharp tomorrow. And with that, he put the phone down. When I arrived at the Carlton Towers, dressed in my best suit, I went up to the receptionist and introduced myself. She picked up the phone to tell Mr. Sabar I was there. A few minutes later, an immaculately dressed man with a moustache appeared. He shook my hand firmly and led me to the bar. As we sat down, he explained matter-of-factly that he was making the arrangements for the funeral as he was Mr. Jafari's personal assistant. Studying me closely, he then asked me if I was good at my job. "You tell me why you are here," he said sharply, nonchalantly lighting a cigarette and leaning back in his seat. "Why?" he repeated. "Why am I here?" I replied, feeling slightly intimidated by Mr. Sabar. I was, after all, only 24, and I still had much to learn about planning and conducting funerals. "I'm here because everybody's told you that I'm the only person who can do this funeral." I felt I needed to be bold and confident with Mr. Sabar, even though I felt nervous in his presence. Yet I reminded myself that a few weeks before, I had conducted the funeral of Mr. Kazem, the UK managing director of the National Iranian Oil Company. "You are right," Mr. Sabar said with a nod. "Well, I must be good in that case. My time is yours. Until the funeral is over, you will own me." Little did I know how true these words were to turn out to be. He smiled thinly. "I hope so, Mr. Albin, because this is going to be one of the most difficult times of your professional life." He instructed me to return to the hotel with two cars at 9 a.m. to take Mr. Jafari, his wife, and himself to Westminster Coroner's Court for the opening of the inquest. The full inquest wouldn't take place until a few weeks later. "Don't be late," were Mr. Sabar's parting words as he walked off towards the lift. The next morning, Freddie Collins and I took two matching black Ford Granadas to the hotel, arriving 15 minutes early. I've always been a very punctual person anyway, but given Mr. Sabar's attitude, I wanted to make doubly certain that I arrived on time. We pulled up in the forecourt of the hotel and waited. Shortly, Mr. Sabar and another well-dressed man emerged, followed by a stocky man with a moustache and an elegantly dressed lady. After Mr. Sabar made the introductions, Mr. Jafari and his wife got in the back of my car, and Mr. Sabar and the other man got in Freddie's car. The coroner, after ruling that Mr. Jafari's son had died from a drug overdose, gave permission for the body to be removed from the mortuary and for burial to take place. Saddened by the cause of death, Mr. Jafari then instructed me to take him around some cemeteries to find a suitable burial place for his son. "I'm never going to return to Iran. That's why I would like my son buried here," he said. "And one day, I will be with him." We spent the whole day visiting cemeteries. I drove him to Kensal Green, then over to Richmond, then on to Putney and Roehampton, then down to Woking, and then up to Grove Park.
Each time, I would point out which plots were available and which sections, if any, were Muslim. Mr. Jafari would pace around silently for a while, then get back in the car and say, "No, not this one. Drive on to the next cemetery, please." I was now beginning to see what Mr. Sabah had meant when he said that these were going to be some of the most difficult days of my life. Finally, Mr. Jafari chose Charlton. I was surprised at this, as the cemetery is very ordinary, and it's in the lower reaches of southeast London. I had thought he would opt for somewhere a bit more ornate, such as Kensal Green. He then announced that he wanted to buy 20 graves, so that all his family could be buried in one place. "Well, Mr. Jafari, the problem is that in London there is a shortage of burial space," I replied, "so families are restricted from buying large numbers of graves at public cemeteries. But because Brookwood, for example, is a private cemetery, you can do that there." He reluctantly accepted this and asked me to buy as many graves as I could at Charlton Cemetery. The following morning, I collected him again at the hotel and drove over to our funeral home, where his son now was. I had embalmed him the night before. This is unusual in Muslim funerals, unless a deceased person is being shipped to another country. But Mr. Jafari was quite westernized in many ways. "I want to dress my son, and I want him standing up," said Mr. Jafari. This was a very unusual request. With tears in his eyes, he helped us to dress his son in a blue Versace suit and tie, and we then stood the coffin up at an angle. I left Mr. Jafari alone in the chapel, thinking that it was very touching for a father to want to help to dress his son. While Mr. Jafari was in the chapel, Mr. Sabah gave me precise instructions about the funeral. He told me Mr. Jafari wanted photographs taken of all the principal mourners, and that people were to phone me to order flowers, and I was to keep a detailed record. "How many cars would you like?" I asked. Opening his briefcase, he pulled out a file and ran his eye down a sheet of paper. "By my calculation, 71 limousines, and matching, please."
"Pardon?"
71 limousines," he repeated. "We will have nearly 300 mourners. Is that a problem, Mr. Albin?"
No, of course not," I spluttered, thinking to myself, yes, this was one hell of a problem. In those days, our entire fleet only consisted of 3 limousines, and the average number of limousines for a funeral was 2. Trying to find this number of cars at such short notice was, I knew, going to be a nightmare. When I returned to the funeral home, Fred Albin and Dad were stunned by Mr. Sabah's request.
"Well, I hope we can get hold of them. You're going to have to do a lot of ringing around, Barry."
Fred had great confidence in me, but I think even he thought I might have bitten off more than I could chew. Nevertheless, he was happy to leave the planning of the funeral to me. That night, I lay in bed worrying about the funeral. It was in 2 days' time. What would I do if I couldn't find the right kind of cars? What would Mr. Sabah say if I had to hire Ford escorts? My reputation was on the line here. But I needn't have worried. Freddie Collins, who ran a local car hire company, came to my rescue. Using his contacts, he tracked down 71 matching limousines. I learned, not for the first time, that in business, so often it's not what you know, it's who you know. I booked a local photographer, Arthur Wood, to take photos of the funeral, and Greens, a florist in St. James Road, to provide the flowers and floral tributes. Over the weekend, the phone never stopped ringing. Iranians from America, Canada, and other parts of the world had flown into London for the funeral, and they all wanted me to go to the Carlton Towers Hotel to show them the floral tribute brochure. Each order had to be listed. Greens had never seen anything like it, and had to rent a railway arch to store the tributes in until the day of the funeral. The day of the funeral finally arrived. It was grey, cold, and wet, a typical London day. I had met with the police and received permission to park all the cars along the bottom of Hyde Park, as there was no way we could park in front of the Carlton Towers. Each car had to display a numbered card on the windscreen, so that the mourners knew which car they were travelling in. I took up position at the entrance to the hotel, and using a two-way radio, called each car down to the forecourt individually, as the mourners came out of the hotel. This took about an hour. Mr. Sabah seemed very impressed by my organisational skills, and, for the first time, gave me a genuine smile,
Very good, Mr. Albin.
When we were ready to depart, I had to have the last car run me down to the hearse, which was in Victoria, because the cortege was so long. Unsurprisingly, many people stopped to stare as the cortege snaked its way across London to our chapel of rest in Bermondsey, where I had arranged refreshments for the principal mourners, who wanted to pay their last respects to Mr. Jafari's son. Because there were so many cars, I had to ask permission from the evangelical church next door to use their car park. The mass of flowers and floral tributes was unbelievable. There must have been at least 1,000. After the ceremonial carrying of the coffin onto the hearse, we set off for Greenwich. I remember stopping in the middle of Blackheath and looking back. It was an unforgettable sight. In the afternoon sunshine, a row of black cars stretched as far as the eye could see. The multitude of floral wreaths and flowers on top of the cars added to the spectacular image. When we reached the grave, which was in the middle of the cemetery, the last car was still out on the main road. The men formed a semicircle, and the women stood behind them, as is traditional at Muslim funerals. Water from Abraham's well was sprinkled. Soil from Mecca was scattered at the graveside, and the body was placed into the grave, facing southeast. Behrouz, an elderly imam, then read a special prayer, asked if anyone was owed anything by the deceased, and then placed soil into the paper on which the prayer was written and dropped it into the grave. Mr. and Mrs. Jafari then dropped soil into the grave, and other mourners were invited to do the same. After this, a wooden stake and a photo of the deceased was placed on top of the grave. It took my team some time to place all the flowers on the grave. Then they gathered all the cards from the floral tributes for Mr. Jafari and his wife to keep. Before people left the graveside, they all bent down to touch the grave and leave behind a personal thought. The cortege travelled back to the Carlton Towers Hotel, where I had arranged a champagne reception in the main ballroom for 1,000 people. Mr. Sabar came up to me towards the end of the evening and said, "Mr. Albin, I need 170 albums with photos of the funeral." I had to do a double take.
170?
Yes, 170, he repeated matter-of-factly.
Is that a problem?
No. No, not at all, Mr. Sabar. And I need them delivered to the hotel by 5 p.m. the day after tomorrow. He paused. Mr. Albin, I did tell you this would be one of the most difficult times of your life, he said, sensing my disbelief. And with that, he was gone.
When I went to Arthur Wood's house to ask him if he could provide the albums, he was flabbergasted.
You're joking, Barry. I don't stock that many, he said, pointing to a dozen or so burgundy albums on a shelf. Well, can't you try some of your contacts? I'm sure they'll have some albums.
I suppose I can, replied Arthur, but I'll need the money to buy them. I don't keep much cash here.
There, I said, handing him a roll of notes. But get your skates on. There's not much time, Arthur.
I'll do my best, Barry.
Arthur did do his best, but even with the help of some of his friends, only managed to complete about 80 albums. It was another week before I delivered the rest to Mr. Jafari, but he understood the reasons for the delay. Despite this funeral being so demanding and exhausting, it really made my reputation within the Iranian community. I learned from it that to be a successful funeral director, you needed to be very well organized and have contingency plans in case things didn't go according to plan. It also underlined how much a funeral director relies upon the help of other funeral directors and businesses, be they car hire companies, florists, or photographers. 5 years later, Mr. Jafari's other son died in similar circumstances in Ireland, and I flew out and brought him back to London. I had to go through the process once again, although the funeral was only half as big this time. 10 years later, I conducted Mr. Jafari's funeral, and in 2000, that of his wife. And when Behrouz, the imam, died, I arranged for his body to be returned to Iran. People wonder how anyone could make death their profession. It must be such a gloomy and depressing job, they say, being surrounded by death. Wouldn't you rather be a doctor, a lawyer, or a teacher? Wouldn't you rather be in a job where you could have a bit of a laugh? And this is what people don't realize.
that the role of the funeral director is primarily to work with the living, not the dead. True, I care for and protect the dead, but I can't restore them to life. Although, as you will hear later, cryonicists in the United States think that they might be able to do this one day. But I can do a great deal for the family and friends a deceased person leaves behind. I can help them to carry on living. And as for having a laugh, well, let me tell you that despite the solemnity and dignity of my work, humour is never far away. Without a doubt, being a funeral director has to be the best job in the world. But in my opinion, it is also probably the hardest. I said to my sons that I would be very proud if they chose to follow me into the business because they wanted to. But if they did it to please me, then it would be the worst job in the world for them.
"Thank God you're here, mate," said the caretaker, as I got out of the private ambulance outside a block of flats on Tower Bridge Road. "I'll tell you what, I ain't going in there, bleeding hell, not likely." "Why, what's the matter?" I asked, opening the back doors to take out the collapsible Washington stretcher. He pulled a face and stubbed out his cigarette on the wall. "You'll find out soon enough." Then with admiration in his voice, he added, "I'll tell you what, I don't envy you, mate. With what you have to do, I wouldn't do it for all the tea in China." He handed me the key to the flat, reminding me to drop it into the estate office the next day, and he was gone. I didn't know what he was referring to. When the coroner's office had phoned to ask if we would remove a deceased man, they hadn't said there was anything unusual to be aware of. As my dad was unwell, I had decided to come on my own. I was 17 and eager to gain experience. Doing a removal is easier with two of you, but it's not that difficult to do alone with a Washington stretcher when a flat is on the ground floor and there are no steps. I had imported one from the USA. It's an easy mover with a sheet of plastic that slides under the deceased. The door of the flat was ajar, and the lights were off. I gingerly pushed it open and flicked the light on the wall, but nothing happened. Switching on my torch, I entered, leaving the stretcher in the hall. It felt cold and spooky. I shone the torch around and then peered into the bathroom. Nothing. But I could smell death. A smell like bad lard, due to the body having been in the flat for a few days. At times like this, when it's hot, I follow this smell in order to locate the body. There will often be flies and maggots around the body. When the maggots hatch and leave the body, they wriggle under the lino. If it's hot, they will bake, making a crunching sound when you step on them. "Any minute now, I am going to fall over the body," I thought, as I checked the toilet. This was scary. And what was the caretaker on about? Why wouldn't he go into the flat? After double-checking all the rooms, I was puzzled and also apprehensive. I was definitely in the right flat, so where was the body? I decided I would have to ring the coroner's office and explain that there was no body there. Before I did, though, I thought I would try to find the mains for the electric. I spotted a cupboard in the hall and opened the door. As I did so, I leapt back in shock. Staring out at me was the contorted face of a man. His eyes were almost out of their sockets, and his tongue was protruding. He was hanging by the belt of his trousers from the hook on the back of the door. His trousers were around his ankles. My God, how on earth could the police doctor have just left him hanging there? Why didn't they cut him down? It was scandalous. When I recovered, I took out my knife, cut the belt, and lifted the deceased. As I placed my arms around him, vomit spewed out of his mouth and all down my back. It was awful. That has to be the most terrifying removal I have ever done. But another particularly gruesome removal occurred when Fred Albin and I were asked to go to Guy's Hospital mortuary one day. When we arrived, we discovered that the deceased person was in fact just a head. It turned out that the police had stopped a car one evening, and upon opening the boot, discovered various human remains in a bag, and the head in a pressure cooker. I later learned that a couple of people had killed the man, chopped him up, and eaten part of him. Even now it makes my stomach churn just thinking about it. Over the years, I have been called to remove numerous bodies from the banks of the Thames.
My dad told me that at one time the Wapping police used to push the body towards Rotherhithe on the opposite side of the river, and the Rotherhithe police used to push the body back towards Wapping. Neither wanted responsibility for it. Late one overcast afternoon, I received a phone call from the coroner's office asking me to go to the riverbank at Greenwich to remove a deceased person. The only information I was given was that the deceased was to be found near the power station. So I set off in one of my private ambulances with Mick, one of our best men. We parked up near the power station, took the fiberglass shell out of the back of the ambulance, put on our protective suits and Wellingtons, grabbed our torches, and walked towards the river path. To my surprise, the police had left the scene. Usually they wait for the funeral director to arrive. We walked up and down the path, but there was no body to be seen anywhere. We were both puzzled. The coroner's office had definitely said that it was near the power station. I went in search of a phone box. Thank God we have mobile phones today, and rang the coroner's office. "Well, we've been up and down the river bank, and we can't see the body anywhere," I said, feeling slightly foolish, but also angry that the police hadn't waited. The coroner's officer said with resignation in his voice that he would come out to locate the body for us. By the time he arrived, it was dark and the tide was coming in. What's more, we were both freezing. "Follow me," he said tersely, and headed off in the direction we'd already come from. Like us, he too walked up and down, unable to spot the body. After a while, he exclaimed, "There it is." True enough, lying in the mud down below was a dark shape that resembled a body. Mick climbed down the ladder on the wall, and I passed him the shell. I followed, and as soon as my feet hit the ground, I was knee-deep in mud. We walked towards the shape, but the deep mud made it very difficult. The shape turned out to be a middle-aged man in a long coat. There was no telling how long he'd been in the river. The smell from the body was awful, and had become twice its normal size because of the gases. To deflate the body, I took out my Swiss Army knife and pricked the man's testicles, which were the size of balloons, and, making a whoosh sound, the air left the body and it went back to its natural size. Squelching through the mud, with the tide lapping around you, to collect a deceased person on a cold November evening is not an experience I would recommend to anyone. The most difficult thing we had to do was climb back up the ladder on the wall while holding onto the shell at the same time. But after a number of struggles, we managed it, just. We then took the deceased to the public mortuary in Ladywell, where a post-mortem was later carried out. It transpired that the deceased was a Norwegian sailor who had got drunk and had fallen overboard. A week later, I conducted his funeral at St. Olave's Norwegian Church, which was built originally as a seaman's mission across the road from the funeral home. I've met some strange doctors over the years, but Dr. Jones, a GP who used to have a surgery on Jamaica Road, probably wins the prize for the most bizarre behaviour. One morning, I went with my dad to move a body at Blackfriars Pier. The police had pulled it out of the water, and then put it on the pier to await the arrival of Dr. Jones. "Where's the body?" he asked briskly, when he arrived. Taken aback, I looked at the policeman and he looked at me. "It's there, Dr. Jones," I said, pointing to the side of the pier. He gave a little snort, and then walked over to the body, knelt down, and took his stethoscope out of his bag and placed it on the man's chest. What on earth was he doing? Judging by the horrendous smell from the body and the condition of the skin, it had probably been there for about 2 weeks. Then Dr. Jones took out a thermometer. Now what was he doing? I couldn't believe it. He pulled down the man's trousers and put the thermometer up his behind to take his temperature. Then he pulled it out, licked his fingers, and pulled them across the thermometer. "Yes, he's dead," concluded Dr. Jones. Then he saw that the police officers, my dad and I, were all smiling. "What's the matter?" he asked, looking slightly miffed. "Did I say something funny?" I was once called by social services to arrange the removal of a deceased man from a flat in Peckham. There was nothing remarkable about this, except that when Dad and I arrived there, we realized that one vital piece of information was missing. The man, who was sitting with his elbow on the table, must have been at least 36 stone. There was no way Dad and I could carry him out. In situations like this, there is only one thing you can do: call the fire brigade.
There were a lot of smiles on the faces of the firemen when they came into the flat. When we moved the table away, the man remained in exactly the same position, because rigor mortis had set in. We strapped the man to a ladder, and, using a winch, the firemen managed to hoist him through one of the windows. Because of the man's size, a coffin had to be specially made, and the cemetery notified. There have been cases when a very large deceased person has arrived at a cemetery or crematorium, and the coffin has been too big to go into the grave or cremator. The following week, when the cortege made its way up Rye Lane with the man's coffin, which was the size of a grand piano, lying on an open-top hearse, there were plenty of bemused looks from shoppers. I have my own coffin finishing and supply company, located near Millwall Football Ground, and producing on average around 4,000 coffins a year. The wood we use comes from trees that are properly forested in places such as South Africa and Austria. For every tree that is cut, two more are planted. We also supply coffin panels, featuring, for example, Our Lady, the Last Supper, and the Sacred Heart. For families who want to have the deceased at home before the funeral, we offer chapel sets, consisting of a crucifix and four large candle stands, all made out of pine or a similar wood. In addition, we import coffins from Peschiera del Garda in Italy. Some years ago, we were asked by Kenyans to make a batch of coffins for the royal family. Although Kenyans still had the royal contract, they had ceased coffin manufacturing. After our premises were inspected by a royal aide, we received a delivery of oak from the Royal Forest at Windsor. Royal coffins are based on the design used to bury Henry VIII, and are all handmade, with a lead shell inside. Instead of nails and screws, we used Oakdale's elephant glue and bitumen. The coffins were taken to a vault at Kensal Green Cemetery for storage. I don't know when and how many of them have been used, but it's quite possible that Princess Diana was buried in one. The reason I can't be sure of this is because Diana's coffin was draped in a flag throughout her funeral. I also have a unique claim to fame in having supplied coffins for both the Shah of Iran and Ayatollah Khomeini. It's quite ironic that while they were divided by their sharp political differences in life, they both ended up being placed in coffins made by a small company in Bermondsey, bringing home the point that we are all equal in death. The design of coffins and caskets hasn't changed much over the years. Coffins are still shaped at the shoulders and rectangular, which gives them that distinctive Gothic look. But the variety has increased. Today you can opt for a biodegradable, veneer, solid wood, wicker, steel, or even gold-plated coffin. Coffins used for transportation of the deceased overseas are always zinc-lined, so that there is no risk of body fluids leaking. In America, caskets are more popular than coffins. Unlike coffins, the top of a casket opens in the manner of a chest. We import them from Marcellus caskets and Batesville caskets in the USA. One of the first American caskets I supplied was for the landlord of the Justice Pub, which featured in the Paul McCartney film Give My Regards to Broad Street, in Bermondsey. The casket was left open and placed in the bar overnight, amidst all the regulars. From then on, caskets started to become popular in the area. One of the specialities of F.A. Albin and Sons is repatriation, returning deceased persons to their homeland. I was first introduced to the international dimension of funeral directing when, as a young boy, I used to accompany Ernie Albin and my dad to Nuffield House, a private wing of Guy's Hospital. Back then, many overseas patients, mainly from the Middle East, came for treatment at Nuffield House. Unfortunately, some died there, and when that happened, they would often be transported back to their homeland. We once turned up at Nuffield House to collect a middle-aged Iraqi woman. When we arrived on the ward, a nurse directed us to the bed where the lady was. As we were lifting her onto the stretcher, all of a sudden, out of her mouth gushed a mass of worms. They were as long as your arm, and the nurse told me afterwards that they had come out of her intestines. I stood there transfixed, both repulsed and fascinated by what I was seeing. With admiration, I watched as my dad and Fred, like the true professionals they were, calmly cleaned the lady up and deposited the worms in a plastic bag to take to the hospital waste incinerator. I can tell you something. It was a long time before I ate spaghetti again. It was when I began doing work for Turner's Air Agency in the 1970s that I really learned about moving human remains between different countries. Through working with Iran Air, I'd learned how to do ticketing, shipping orders, and various other tasks involved in transporting human remains overseas. The Iranian embassy would often phone me to ask if I could get so-and-so on a flight to Iran. Shipping human remains between different countries is a complex business, and very lucrative for airlines, who always say freight pays for the fuel. What makes this work difficult is that each country and airline has different rules. That was why I wrote a small booklet on the subject for the UK funeral industry. With so much cargo passing through airports, it isn't uncommon for bodies to get lost or even sent to the wrong countries. Not many people know that deceased persons are not allowed to be stored with animals during a flight, because animals have an adverse reaction to dead people. Because of the risk of fluid leaking from human remains, most countries insist, quite correctly, that coffins are metal-lined and hermetically sealed. They are carried only in a hold or cargo section designated for human remains. A coffin has to be weighed both by the funeral director and the airline. The heavier it is, the more expensive it is. A coffin usually has to receive the embassy seal and be checked to make sure it doesn't contain drugs, guns, or explosives. Transporting human remains around the world can lead to problems. One night, I received a phone call from the manager of a warehouse at Cargo Village, Heathrow Airport. Although some airlines have their own chapels of rest at Heathrow, most place human remains in a section in one of the warehouses. The manager explained that he'd received a coffin from Morocco, and it was due to be shipped to the Middle East, but the remains inside were leaking. As a result, he had been forced to close off the area of the warehouse where the deceased person was, causing massive disruption and delaying flights. The reason for this is the risk to public health that a spillage could cause. I knew the manager well as a result of previously transporting remains back to Iran, and agreed to help him out. When I walked into the huge warehouse, located on the edge of the airport, the manager's face lit up. "Barry, I don't know what I would have done without you." He took me to the far side of the warehouse and gestured to a table where I could carry out the embalming. The warehouse was icy cold. No wonder the manager had a heavy coat and gloves on. A forklift truck brought the coffin over and lowered it onto the table.
"Phew, what a stench,"
squirmed the manager, turning his head away as I unfastened the coffin lid. "I've smelt worse," I replied with a chuckle, as I put on my face mask before carefully lifting the remains out of the coffin and onto a table. Whoever had embalmed this gentleman had done a very poor job. A considerable amount of body fluid had already drained out of the deceased, an elderly Moroccan man. I opened my case and took out my spatula, aesthesium hook, vein drains, trocar, forceps and arterial clamps, and then prepared the fluids. It was a difficult and messy job, made more difficult by not having the full facilities of our mortuary available, and also by the cold conditions. I always talk to the deceased person while I embalm. It might sound weird, but it helps me to remember that the body on the table in front of me is a person. As long as deceased persons are in my care, I treat them as if they were still alive. After several hours, I succeeded in making the man look presentable, placed him in the zinc-lined coffin I had brought with me, and sealed it. Before leaving, I checked the gentleman's name tag, made a note of it in my book, signed a declaration that the body had been embalmed according to the correct international procedures, and the coffin didn't contain guns, drugs, or anything else apart from the deceased, and then, as usual, washed my hands with antibacterial soap. Over the years, I have also arranged for a large number of deceased British people to be brought back home, including several celebrities. Through my consultancy work with Pompe Funèbre Générale, France's biggest funeral directors, I had a reputation as someone who knew how the French funeral industry worked. One day, in 1995, I received a phone call from a theatrical agent asking me if I would go to Nice to bring back human remains. "Yes, what's the person's name?" I asked. "Donald Pleasence," came the reply. Donald Pleasence was one of the best-known actors of his generation. Although he had appeared in classic films such as All Quiet on the Western Front, The Great Escape, and The Eagle Has Landed, he built up a reputation for playing sinister roles in films such as You Only Live Twice and Halloween. After Donald's remains were flown into Heathrow, we took him to the funeral home, and a few days later he was cremated at Putney Vale Crematorium. Afterwards, his wife invited me back to her house in Putney for a reception. She was a lovely woman, and the two of them had enjoyed what you might call a champagne lifestyle. I spent an absolutely fascinating few hours mingling with people I had only ever seen on TV. Amongst them were Ian McShane, Bill Wyman, Sir Richard Attenborough, Sir John Gielgud, and Alan Bates, who booked me for his funeral, although whether that was him or the champagne talking, I don't know. That night, BBC TV News carried a report of the funeral, and a couple of weeks later I found myself appearing in OK Magazine, which had also covered it. A very different repatriation was that of Scottish rock star Alex Harvey, who died in Bruges. Norman Dugdale, his agent, who I played football with at the Polytechnic of Central London, phoned me up and asked me if I would bring Alex's body back to England. I went over to Bruges with Father Frank Carter, who taught me much about bereavement. Frank, who was seriously ill with cancer at the time, was very gregarious and a fan of trivia. I always remember him telling me on the way there that classical music was used on TV commercials because if it was over 50 years old, no rights had to be paid. Arriving at the mortuary, tucked away in a small street in one of the suburbs, I was amazed to discover that Belgian law did not require the coroner to disclose the cause of death to the family. I was absolutely shocked by the state of Alex's body. I learned that the autopsy hadn't been completed. Back then in Belgium, after autopsies, remains were placed in a coffin, which was sealed and never opened again. Families were prohibited from viewing their loved one. When we got Alex's remains back to the funeral home, I had to spend many hours practically rebuilding him before his wife could see him. She wouldn't have recognized him otherwise. As you might expect, the funeral at Golders Green Crematorium was a star-studded affair. Amongst the mourners were two of the Rolling Stones, Ian Dury and Kid Jensen. During the service, Alex's music was played. Because Norman's business went bust, and Alex's wife had no money, it took me 5 years to get paid. That happened when Capital Radio decided to start playing Alex's records, which provided royalties for his wife. Funeral directors, I believe, can provide valuable assistance. Not just when a manager of an airport warehouse is in a crisis because of a leaking coffin, but also at major disasters. The first major incident I was directly involved in was the Moorgate train crash in 1975. We received a call that morning from the police informing us that there had been a serious train crash and asking if we could come and help to remove some of the bodies and take them to the mortuary at Golden Lane in the city. It transpired that around 8:40 a.m. a train packed with commuters sped past Platform 9 at twice its usual speed of 15 miles per hour and ran out of track, ramming into a dead-end tunnel. There were chaotic scenes when we pulled up outside the station. Ambulances and police cars were parked everywhere, and nurses and doctors were running around in a panic. Accompanied by two police officers, we were led through the station and down to the platform. The first thing that really hit me was the smell of death. The smell is something I have become very familiar with over the years. It's very hard to describe, but it's a terrible smell, and it makes you want to vomit. This, I think, is your body's way of protecting you. I was shocked by what I saw when we reached the platform. The first three of the six coaches had telescoped at the end of the tunnel after crushing through sand piles and over the buffers. We picked our way through the carriages towards the front of the train. It was eerie. A couple of hours before, these carriages were full of people on their way to another day at the office. Many were now lying in hospitals or dead. We made several trips to remove deceased persons from Moorgate during the next 2 days. When Golden Lane mortuary filled up, we were forced to use guys. I remember when we neared the front of the train, we discovered that the first 15 feet of it had been compressed into 2 feet and embedded in the wall. Reaching the cab, I found the driver sitting there with his hand on the accelerator lever. He was squashed up to about 6 inches wide. The final death toll was 35. With many more injured, making it one of the capital's worst rail disasters for many years. Over the years, F.A. Albin and Sons have carried out repatriations for Greeks, Portuguese, Spaniards, Iraqis, Nigerians, and many other nationalities, but the company has built up a particularly close relationship with Britain's Iranian community, ever since we repatriated the nephew of the Shah of Iran. We have repatriated thousands of Iranians, and also buried many more in Britain. Today, there are still around 200 deceased Iranians buried in steel coffins in special sandy graves at Brookwood Cemetery. Their families are waiting patiently for things to change before repatriating their loved ones. Our relations with the Iranian embassy under both regimes have always been excellent. I put this down to the fact that I have no political agenda, and that Iranians are kind and loyal people. Furthermore, the staff have never mocked my attempts at speaking Farsi. Well, not often, anyway. In 1977, I opened a funeral agency in Iran. I had signed a contract with Balfour Beatty and BICC, two of the major contractors working there. The arrangement was that I would take charge of their deceased employees. I took the lease on an apartment in Abadan, owned by Balfour Beatty, bought a Mercedes ambulance, and employed Dr. Fazal, a pleasant American-trained local doctor, to carry out embalming for me, live in the apartment, and run the business. I taught Dr. Fazal all he needed to know about embalming and repatriation, and sent him a supply of international shipping coffins and embalming equipment and fluids. The work went very well. We shipped a number of human remains to various countries, including Italy, Germany, and America. But when politics and religion clashed in 1979, and revolution swept through the country, my business closed. Incidentally, I still have my Bank Melli checkbook, and also a bottle of Iranian vodka, unopened, and, I imagine, very rare. I was leaving the Iranian embassy one morning in April 1980 after a meeting with one of the diplomats about my account in Iran. It still contained a significant sum. On my way out, Mr. Ali, the receptionist, invited me to join him for a cup of tea, something he often did. I shook my head. "No, I've got a funeral to do, Mr. Ali." "By the way," I said, pulling one of the new 50-pence pieces out of my pocket and handing it to him, "have you seen this?" He examined it closely in the palm of his hand. I told him that I had heard that some of the 50p's had been minted with 11 hands instead of 10. If you found a 50-pence piece with 11 hands, it'd be worth a lot of money. "Really, Albin," he replied brightly, handing the coin back to me. "No, keep it. For luck," I replied, dropping it into his top pocket. This insignificant exchange, I was to learn later, would be one that Mr. Ali would never forget. I said goodbye to the policeman who was standing between the inner and outer doors. As I was walking down the road to my car, I can recall a group of three rough-looking men of Middle Eastern appearance deliberately brushing past me. I was annoyed by their rudeness, but thought no more of it until half an hour later when, on the car radio, I heard that the embassy had been stormed. What became known as the Iranian embassy siege lasted for 6 days, until live on TV, the SAS dramatically stormed the building amidst gunfire and explosions. And as Albins were known to be the official funeral directors for the Iranian embassy, we had been put on red alert by the coroner's office. The first call to attend the embassy came on Monday afternoon. The press officer had been shot dead, and his body dumped on the pavement outside. Dad and I headed over to Kensington in a private ambulance, placed the deceased in a shell, and took him to St. Stephen's Hospital mortuary. Then a few hours later, the SAS burst into the embassy, and within minutes put an end to the siege. We received another call, and once again set off for Kensington. When we neared Prince's Gate, we were stopped at a police checkpoint. The ambulance was inspected, our ID carefully checked by the police, and we were then waved through. Driving slowly on, there was an eerie silence along what is usually one of London's busiest roads. Police cars and fire engines were lined up on the park side. Scaffolding and floodlights had been erected in front of the embassy. Smoke still hung in the air. A senior policeman directed us to the entrance. We took three stretchers and a shell out of the back of the ambulance and walked through the front door. The dreadful stench of death hit me immediately. The wonderful winding staircase, the chandeliers, Persian carpets and marvellous paintings had all been burnt, while on the walls slogans had been scrawled in Farsi, Arabic and English. In the telex room, we found two bodies lying in pools of blood. I saw another body at the foot of the staircase, and a fourth a little way up. The bodies were still hot because of the fire. Looking around, I realized how close I had been to being caught up in the siege. We put three bodies on stretchers and one in a shell, carried them out, and then loaded them into the ambulance. We were given a police escort to Westminster Coroner's Court, where the autopsies were to take place. Afterwards, I went to the Westminster Hospital to visit Mr. Arley and Mr. Darney, who had both been shot during the siege.
"You saved my life, Mr. Barry," Mr. Arley said with emotion when I walked into his room.
"How?" I asked, puzzled. I wasn't even at the embassy during the siege.
"Do you remember that 50-pence piece you gave me on the morning of the siege?"
"Yes," I replied, wondering what the connection was.
"Well, if it had not been for that, I would not be sitting up talking to you now. When the man fired the gun at me, the bullet hit the 50-pence piece in my top pocket."
He paused, and with emotion in his voice said, "That coin you gave me saved my life." I was amazed, and stood there in silence, not knowing what to say. Ever since, Mr. Ali has always sent me a card and some pistachio nuts at Christmas. We take public cemeteries for granted nowadays, but they only originated in the Victorian period after concerns that some churchyards posed a health risk. Despite being only 60 metres square, it was estimated that as many as 60 or 70,000 people were buried in the churchyard at St. Martin-in-the-Fields. The Burial Act of 1852 closed churchyards and required the General Board of Health to open cemeteries in the London suburbs. The Romans, in fact, forbade the burial of bodies inside a city's walls. The majority of the funerals I conduct are in South and East London. But if I am taking a funeral to the City of London Cemetery and Crematorium, for example, I will never drive the hearse through the Rotherhithe or Blackwall Tunnel. And the reason is that you never take anyone underground before their time. It might sound strange, but I have always followed this tradition. If Tower Bridge is closed, I'll go to Southwark Bridge, and if that's closed, I'll go to Blackfriars Bridge. I've never had a family complain about this. If they ask why we are going a long way round to get to the cemetery, I tell them it's because Arthur Albin told me, "Never go underground before your time," and they love it. If anyone ever told me to go under the tunnel, I wouldn't. The weather plays a key part in a funeral. I've seen cases where water has flooded graves and they have caved in, and once the vicar and I slipped and disappeared into a grave after the edge gave way. I remember once doing a funeral at Nunhead in thick fog. You could only see about a foot in front of you. The gravedigger walked ahead with a lamp, while I drove behind in the hearse with the headlights on. It took us about an hour to find the grave, and 2 hours to find our way out. Over the years, I have successfully exhumed a number of bodies, and it always seems to be at 4 a.m, when you have the mist floating across the cemetery. Exhumations are usually carried out because a family is dissatisfied with the cemetery, or they want their loved one nearer home. In some cases, a family might have bought a larger plot and want to have all their family together. The reason why exhumations are done at such an early hour is so that it doesn't take place in view of the public. Permission from the Home Office must be obtained before an exhumation can take place. You fill out a form stating who owns the grave, whether there are any objections to the exhumation, whether the grave contains anyone else, why you want to do the exhumation, and where the body is to be moved to. If one person is buried on top of another in a public grave, then there is no problem in opening it. However, if they are buried beneath other bodies, then permission from the other families must be sought before an exhumation can take place. Once the Home Office clears the application, they issue the funeral director with a license to exhume, and they write to the cemetery. If you exhume a body from a Church of England cemetery, you need to obtain a faculty from the local bishop. The fear of premature burial is a deep one. Since the time of Duke Ferdinand of Brunswick in the late 1700s, there have been numerous cases where the deceased has been buried in what is known as a security coffin, which would often have an air hole and a rope attached to the hand of the deceased and linked to a bell above. and as recently as the mid-1990s, it was reported that an Italian watchmaker had marketed a coffin equipped with a bleeping device, a telephone, a flashlight, an oxygen tube, and a heart stimulator. Once, at an exhumation at Nunhead Cemetery, I discovered scratch marks on the inside of the coffin and pieces of fingernail in the bottom of it. I was told that this was the result of someone being buried alive a couple of hundred years before. I once conducted the funeral for a man who was buried with an alarm bell in his hand, a fully charged mobile phone, and some food in case he woke up. As we carried the coffin, I couldn't help but think, what if we bumped it and the alarm went off? Or the phone rang? In December 2000, I carried out one of the most unusual funerals I have ever done, that of the bones of between 30 and 40 people who died in southeast London in the 18th century and were discovered by staff from the British Museum during an archaeological dig. The vicar of St. Paul's, Deptford, approached me one day and explained that he wanted the remains given a proper funeral. We collected the bones from the church and placed them each in an individual small coffin. Two coffins were placed in each hearse, and we drove to the church, which was then in the middle of renovation, for a service. I and my team formed a circle around the open coffins, and the vicar stood in the middle and individually blessed each set of human remains. Later, when the renovation work has been completed, the remains will be buried in the churchyard at St. Paul's. Some people might think all of this unnecessary, and that we should have simply put the bones in a black bin liner, but the vicar and I both believed in the sacredness of the body. Today, two-thirds of funerals in the UK are bound not for the cemetery, but for the crematorium. Arthur Albin could not accept cremation because he held to the traditional Christian view that it was incompatible with the resurrection of the body. The legalization of cremation was due in part to the eccentric Dr. William Price. At the age of 83, he fathered a child. When the child died, aged 5 months, Price attempted to cremate the body at the top of a hill. At his trial in Cardiff in 1884, the judge ordered the jury to find Price not guilty, as no British law forbade cremation unless it was carried out in a manner that would cause a public nuisance or prevent a coroner from holding an inquest. Soon after, at Woking, 20,000 people turned up to watch William Price himself become the first person in Britain to be publicly cremated. When I meet people at social gatherings and I tell them I'm a funeral director, very often the conversation turns to cremation. They want to know if we actually cremate the coffin and if we take the handles off beforehand. These questions are tied up with a general suspicion that funeral directors remove valuable personal effects, such as jewellery, before a cremation or burial. When I tell them that, yes, the coffin is cremated and, no, we don't take off jewellery, unless requested to do so by the family, and yes, they are the genuine ashes of the deceased person concerned, they often give me one of those disbelieving looks. But it is perfectly true. Many people are unaware that it's not the cremator that produces the ashes of the deceased person. After a cremation, a number of bones are still left. The ashes are created by placing the bones in a container with some ball bearings, and then putting it into a machine which rotates very quickly. The ball bearings contact with the bones, grinding them to ashes. Afterwards, a magnet is used to extract the ball bearings, leaving only the ashes of the person cremated. One of my major successes was in 2000, when I opened the UK's first private cremation cemetery, the Albin Memorial Garden, on land next to my funeral home. It is open to anyone and has space for the ashes of nearly 1 million deceased persons. My dream only came true after a 7-year battle with Southwark Council and with London Underground, who were then building the Jubilee Line extension, which runs under my funeral home. In the cremation cemetery, remains of between 4 to 6 people can be deposited in niches, which are sealed with a granite stone. The underground ashbarium is the first of its kind in the country. 1/3 of it is above ground and 2/3 below ground. Inside it is a memorial book in which you can record the name of a loved one. Around the walls are shelves for depositing ashes. In the rose garden, we move a slab and scatter the ashes into shingle and sulphur. Eventually, the ashes go to feed the roses, part of life's great plan, I like to think. The memorial wall is a much smaller version of the one in Washington, D.C., that records the names of those killed in Vietnam. The Albin Dyer Bermondsey and Rotherhithe Foundation, a charity I set up, provides vases for families who want to lay flowers along the floral wall. On a lighter note, shortly after the Ashbarium opened, Georgie, a local totter, a sort of Delboy character, drove into the yard in his van.
"Now, I've got a bit of gear for you. It'll be lovely for the new garden at Christmas."
"What is it?" I inquired, knowing that Georgie often found some very useful stuff.
"Just you wait and see," he said excitedly, opening the back of the van. "Here you are. 10 quid each, that's all I'm asking, Belle."
He was holding up a 2-foot Santa Claus figure that lit up, but it had no hands.
"George, you must be joking if you think I'm going to put those in my garden." "What's up with them?" he asked. "What's up with them? They've got no hands, Georgie, that's what's up with them, and they're tacky."
No sooner had I said this than Freddie Collins came out of the garage next door and immediately bought 2. No accounting for taste, is there?
A question many bereaved families have when they meet the funeral director is whether to have the deceased embalmed. I will never carry out an embalming without the permission of the bereaved family. Where an embalming is not being carried out, we will still wash and dress the deceased. However, we will have to keep them in the refrigerator in our state-of-the-art mortuary, and we will transfer him or her into the chapel when a family want to come to the funeral home for a viewing. When Albin's began over 200 years ago, embalming was unheard of, at least for ordinary people. In the 19th century, it was common amongst the poor for bodies to be left in the house for weeks. It was not unheard of for a wife to kiss her deceased husband, contract a fever, and then die. As late as the 1960s, embalming was still not that common amongst funeral directors in Britain. On the occasions when it was carried out, the embalmer would virtually bleach all the skin, and the body would become hard. This went some way to preserving the body, but it did nothing in terms of presentation. Today, the British Institute of Embalming offers a 3-year course, consisting of theory and practice, in conjunction with firms of funeral directors and various academic institutions. Scientific embalming is a process similar to blood transfusion or dialysis. Apart from slowing decomposition, embalming removes the harsh physical effects brought about by an accident or illness, and restores a person's natural appearance. Soon after death, the body begins to decompose, and it might turn green in some parts and form blisters in another part. The breakdown of body tissues releases various gases, which cause blisters under the skin and swelling of the stomach and torso. If the body isn't embalmed or refrigerated, the swelling can cause it to burst open. It was common years ago to have a body explode on you because of the gas that had built up. Sometimes the side of the coffin would blow off. On other occasions, the stomach would inflate, or you'd be carrying the coffin downstairs, only to find that it was leaking. The first time this happened was when I was about 10 years of age. With 5 minutes to go before the funeral, my dad and Uncle Fred couldn't get the lid on the coffin. Panicking, my dad told me to sit on it. When I did, I could feel myself going up in the air. "Dad, I'm moving!" I cried out. "Just sit there, boy. You're doing a good job," he replied coolly, as he struggled to fasten down the lid. If you were unable to get the lid on, there was only one thing for it. You had to pierce the body in order to release the gas and deflate it. Embalming is best carried out as soon after death as possible, when the body is still warm. This is because after death the body begins to change. The muscles relax, causing defecation and urination. Later, they become tense and rigid, producing rigor mortis, usually lasting between 12 and 24 hours. During this period, the body cools to the temperature of the surroundings, and the blood collects in the lowest parts, often causing the skin to turn a light blue color. The bladder, the bowels, the kidneys, and the heart all have to be drained, and the muscles have to be exercised to break down the rigor mortis. It is a foundation stone of embalming that during the process no organs are to be removed. Neither embalmers nor funeral directors are allowed to do this under any circumstances, nor do they ever do it. True, an embalmer opens up a body and removes various parts, but it's understood that after they have all been treated with cavity fluid, he will replace each one. We have a belief that it takes somebody a couple of days to settle down after they have died,
When you put somebody in the chapel of rest, their face changes dramatically in the first 48 hours. The pain seems to go, and their features soften and relax. I believe visiting people after their death is very important, as is how you present them. There's nothing worse than for someone to walk into the chapel of rest and say, "That's not my mum. It doesn't look anything like her." There was one memorable time when I was showing two sisters, Joan and Daisy, their brother, in the chapel of rest. He had died while on holiday at Hailing Island. When they saw him, they withdrew in horror. I froze. What was the matter? Had I shown them the wrong body? Then one of the sisters said, "Oh, Daisy, don't he look well?" The other replied, "God help us, Joe, that holiday's done him good. Look at his colour. Beautiful." The first murder scene I ever attended was at the age of 15, when I went with my dad to remove the body of a bookie who had been shot dead in his shop on Jamaica Road. The policeman standing outside the door greeted my dad in a jovial manner. He gave me a brief glance and then asked, "Is the lad going to be all right?" "He's a keen lad, and he's got to see his first murder at some point if he's going to make it in the business," replied my dad. In those days, funeral directors would be called to a murder scene immediately, as the police relied upon them to provide the body bags. Unlike today, we knew all the police, police doctors, coroner's officers and pathologists by their first name. We went into the small shop, where an inspector informed us that some youths had broken in and demanded money. When the bookie said he didn't have any, one of the youths shot him through the chest. I was shocked at this. The inspector lifted up the flap of the counter and motioned us through. Lying there in a pool of blood was the bookie. He looked about the same age as my dad. Around him were screwed-up betting slips, which reminded me of confetti. A police photographer was carefully recording the scene, while a fingerprint expert was busy dusting the handle of the door that led to the flat at the back. Today, a murder scene would be sealed off until all this work had been completed. After we had placed the bookie in the ambulance, we got in the front, but my dad didn't start the engine. "What's up, Dad?" "We gotta wait, son," he replied. "What for?" I asked, puzzled. "For the police escort," replied my dad, without even a hint of excitement. A police escort? My heart pounded. This was brilliant. Shortly, a police officer came out of the shop, signalled to my dad, and got into a police car. With the blue light flashing and the siren on, he moved off, and we followed. As we threaded our way through the streets of Bermondsey to the mortuary at Guy's Hospital, I felt so important, and concluded that being a funeral director had to be the best job in the world. The next day, two police officers turned up at our funeral shop and asked me to accompany them to Tower Bridge Police Station in order to eliminate me from their inquiry. My fingerprints had, it transpired, been found in the bookies. Dad didn't seem too alarmed, and reassured me that it was just routine. Sitting in a small, bare room at the police station, dipping my fingers in ink was a frightening experience, even though I knew I had nothing to do with the murder. At the same time, though, to be part of a murder inquiry was fascinating. The following week at school, the boy who usually sat next to me in class was absent. I assumed he was ill. Then, during the afternoon break one day, I overheard two other boys discussing him in hushed tones. "What's happened to him?" I asked. Their eyes widened as they looked at me. "Don't you know?" "Know what?" I replied, wondering if he'd had an accident. "He's been arrested." "Arrested? Why? What's he done?" "They reckon he shot that bookie on Jamaica Road last week," replied the taller one. "Can you believe it, Barry?" I couldn't believe it. The boy didn't have a reputation as a real tough character. True, he had been in a few fights, but that was common in Bermondsey. I later learned that the boy had carried out the murder in a moment of madness and stupidity. I still see the wife of the bookie today, and when I do, I reflect how that moment of madness changed her life forever. Since then, I have conducted numerous funerals of murder victims. This part of London, it has to be said, has more than its fair share of murders. In most cases, the victim knew his or her killer. All murders are shocking, but for me, there is something particularly evil about a child being murdered,
and laying to rest a murdered child is one of the hardest things I ever have to do. One of the most traumatic funerals I have ever conducted was for 4-year-old Stacey Kavanagh from Rotherhithe. The bodies of Stacey and her friend, 7-year-old Tina Beechook from the East End, were discovered under a pile of leaves in Southwark Park, which backs onto my funeral home. The children had both been strangled. Like everyone in the community, I was deeply shocked. Watching the two mothers make a tearful and emotional appeal on TV for the killer to be caught really cut me up. Stacey's funeral at St. Mary's Church, near the flats where she lived, was one of the biggest seen in the area for many years. In a display of sympathy, people lined the whole route of the funeral. Murders in Bermondsey and Rotherhithe have usually been the result of gangland feuds or domestic situations. The murder of an innocent child was unheard of. There were so many floral tributes that we were unable to place them all on the 16 limousines and hearse, and had to provide an open-back lorry for the remainder. The person eventually charged with both murders was the mother of Tina. A final sinister twist was that a few months before, the workshop at my funeral home had been broken into, and some babies' coffins stolen. When the police searched the mother's flat, they found one of the stolen coffins under a bed. I found this news spine-chilling. I have kept in touch with Stacey's parents, and her mother remains a wonderful inspiration to me. The murder of 11-year-old Nigerian schoolboy Damilola Taylor in a stairwell on the North Peckham estate in December 2000 was an event that shocked the whole nation. What made this murder particularly horrific was that Damilola had apparently been killed by other children. When I heard about the murder, I immediately contacted the police family welfare officer and offered to conduct Damilola's funeral. This wasn't out of any desire for cheap publicity, but simply a gesture of kindness and support to Damilola's family in their hour of darkness. They had decided that they didn't want any publicity, and no one would know where the funeral would take place. I knew that Albin's would provide them with the best funeral they could possibly hope for, and we would do everything to make it a day that would live on in the memory for many years to come. It took 2 days to embalm Damilola, as he had been dead for some time. After this, we dressed him in his own clothes and placed him in a white coffin. Damilola's parents then changed their mind over publicity about the funeral. They did this, I think, to draw attention to the terrible death their son had undergone. I met with the police to discuss the funeral route and security. There were fears not only that some groups might cause problems, but also about the number of TV crews and journalists expected. The cortege set off from Culling Road and was met near Woolwich Barracks by two police outriders who escorted us to All Saints Church, Plumstead. MPs, including Paul Boateng, Simon Hughes and Anne Widdicombe, the Nigerian High Commissioner and leading figures from the Nigerian community were among those who packed the church, as Damilola's coffin was carried up the aisle by 6 bearers. Also present were a number of black police officers, and Doreen Lawrence, mother of Stephen Lawrence, who was stabbed to death a few years before in Eltham. High above, a police helicopter hovered, while outside other mourners, including a number of children, stood silently in the street, listening to the service over loudspeakers. Afterwards, we took Damilola to Plumstead Cemetery for a private burial, away from the glare of TV cameras and prying eyes of journalists. At the graveside, I was handed a box and asked to release a dove. This was the first time I had ever done anything like this, and I felt quite privileged. But I think what really sticks in my mind was when I was walking the funeral towards the church. There was total silence in the street, and then suddenly I heard click, 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 click. Photographers were everywhere, on roofs, leaning out of windows, on balconies. The sound was almost deafening. At that moment, I realized for the first time the magnitude of the effect this funeral had on the nation. My job is to care for and bury the dead, whoever they might be, and whatever they might have done or not done. I have often reflected that there can be few professions where you work with such a cross-section of society and in such an intimate way. Many of those who move in the underworld are extremely tough, but when they deal with a funeral director, they are very humble, grateful, and respectful. I am sure that Englishes, the Bethnal Green funeral directors who conducted the funerals for the Krays, would say exactly the same. There is a tradition of the heads of gangland families or firms being on first-name terms with the local funeral director. For example, we buried the father of the Richardson family, who, with the Krays, controlled much of the organised crime in London. He was a great character, who used to feed all the Bermondsey stray cats and dogs, and on the day of his death had visited the local pet shop. Although I have never ever been involved in any criminal activity, I was once accused of planning the escape of a prisoner. A local villain had been let out for a family funeral at Nunhead Cemetery. As he was a small-time crook, the prison officers hadn't bothered to handcuff him. They had agreed that after the funeral he could go back to the house where his family were giving a reception. I opened the door of the limousine for the man to get in, and he legged it out the other side and made off, zigzagging between the gravestones. The prison officers gave chase, but the man was too quick. That night his mother phoned me up and blamed me for his escape. When I tried to explain that I was an undertaker, not a prison officer, she wouldn't listen, insisting the door on the far side of the car should have been locked, while ignoring the point that he should have had more respect than to escape during a funeral. If you buy 1,000 marbles, put them in a box, and then each day take one out and throw it away, you suddenly start to realise how short 3 years is. Tellingly, after the death of Princess Diana in 1997, I was inundated with people wanting to take out prepaid funerals. Our business increased fivefold during a three-month period. I put this down to the impact Diana's death had on people's perception of their own mortality. I have always seen my role as a funeral director as being to carry out a corporate act of mercy. I think there is something very special or sacred about laying a soul to rest, and I am sure that the soul or spirit of the person who has died remains present through those days before the burial or cremation. When Father Power, a former priest at the Church of the Most Holy Trinity, Dockhead, was dying of cancer of the liver in King's College Hospital, I went to visit him. Sitting at his bedside, I was taken aback when he admitted to me that he was frightened of death. Father Power was a tough character, who had been in the Marines before entering the priesthood. "But, Father, you believe in God? Where's your faith?" I asked. He looked at me and said, "Barry, there's nothing more frightening than going into the unknown." At the time, I was shocked by his fear of death. I assumed that a priest's faith would overcome this. But I now know that this is not the case. No matter who a person is, or how strong his faith, there will always be a fear of death, because death is the ultimate mystery, and we are human beings. Father Power was in fact influential in my decision to become a Catholic. Catholicism seemed to me to be the religion that best made sense of the world. The memory of the care provided by Father McManus and the Sisters of Mercy at Dockhead when my mother died has always stayed with me. I've never forgotten Father McManus putting his arm on my shoulder and saying, "Dying is just as much a part of life as living. And you've got to live." Over the years, I'd talked to various priests about Catholic beliefs and teachings. Some had drawn me nearer to the church, others further away. Gradually, the desire to share in communion grew in me. I didn't see communion as just a reenactment of the Last Supper. I really saw it as the body of Christ, a chance to be one with him. However, I found the church's teachings on issues such as birth control a stumbling block, and furthermore, I didn't want to indoctrinate my children. When I told a priest about my difficulties, he replied, "Do you think that I agree with everything the church teaches? I don't and can't. But I realize that Catholicism is available for everyone, and you have to find your place in it. You have to accept what you can. God still accepts you because he can understand what you can't accept." This gave me the encouragement I needed. I attended weekly instruction, but nevertheless still found it hard to make the final leap of faith. What's more, I was the chairman of governors of a Church of England school. However, I eventually made the decision after a priest said to me, "Come on board and see where it takes you." I was received into the Roman Catholic Church at the Church of the Most Holy Trinity, Dockhead. It took me a long time to become a Catholic. I never deny I'm a Catholic, and I always make it clear what I believe in.
I have some main teachings that I use in my daily life. The easiest thing in the world should be to put God first every time. In fact, it's the hardest thing. In everything I do, I always try to think what's right for that other person I'm dealing with, not just what's right for me. Most, but not all, Catholic funerals are requiem masses, that is, a service where the Eucharist is central to the worship. Where a family's link with the church is not strong, a simple service may be held, either in the church or in the cemetery or crematorium chapel. Nowadays, many Catholic priests have abandoned black vestments in favour of white or purple, and in these more enlightened times, a person who has committed suicide is no longer denied a full Catholic funeral. Generally, eulogies are not common. Instead, the priest will preach a homily with the intention of making it personal to the deceased and his or her family. As is traditional, the priest will always bless the grave with holy water before the prayers of farewell are said. Music plays an important part in a funeral service and can express much about a person's life. In recent years, many Christian denominations have allowed bereaved families a much wider choice of music than traditional hymns, such as The Lord's My Shepherd and Abide With Me. I wonder if Frank Sinatra realized that he was recording one of the all-time top 10 hits for funerals. I've lost count of the times that I've heard My Way played at a funeral. Mind you, the songs some people choose to be played at funeral services are, let's say, somewhat unexpected. Chain Gang, for a man who died in prison. YMCA, at a gay funeral. Hello Mother, Hello Father, for a mum and dad. Magical Mystery Tour, Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And Shep the Dog. Believe it or not, in crematorium chapels I have heard Hearts on Fire, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and Elton John's Love Lies Burning. Once, at the Requiem Mass for a young man who died of a brain tumour, we carried the coffin out to the beat of It Must Be Love by Madness. Another time, at the funeral of an old Bermondsey lady at Lewisham Crematorium, a tape of her singing Wish Me Luck As You Wave Me Goodbye was played as the coffin was committed. It was fantastic. All her family and friends were tapping their feet and singing along. Afterwards, the minister led everyone in a round of applause for the lady. Over the years, I have conducted numerous funerals for people of other faiths. As I've already said, Albin's has a very special relationship with Britain's Iranian community, the majority of whom are Muslims. In Islam, simplicity is the hallmark of a funeral, which should normally take place as soon as possible after death. As I've explained, generally bodies are not embalmed unless they are travelling abroad, but they are washed and then sprinkled with perfume. A deceased person will be wrapped in white sheets called a kafan, 3 for a man and 5 for a woman. Usually, there are no flowers or floral tributes, as this is seen as a waste. It is prayer, not flowers, that the deceased person needs, in Islamic thinking. In Islam, to be involved in a burial is one of the greatest kindnesses you can do. This is because a person cannot repay you. Through my work with the Iranian community, I have also conducted a number of funerals for Britain's 6,000-strong Baha'i community. The Baha'i faith originated in Iran, then Persia, in the 1840s, as an offshoot of Islam. According to Baha'i beliefs, the deceased person should be buried as close as possible to where he or she died, no more than an hour's travelling distance from that place. So if a person dies overseas, they will not be brought back home. Many Baha'is asked to be buried at the Great Northern Cemetery in New Southgate, where Shoghi Effendi, the guardian of the Baha'i faith and great-grandson of its founder, was buried after he died while visiting London in 1957. As with Islam, cremation is not allowed and, unless the law requires it, embalming is not recommended. The deceased is usually wrapped in either silk or cotton, and for Baha'is over 15 years of age, a ring may be placed on the finger. At a Baha'i funeral there is often poetry, readings, a eulogy and songs. When what is called the obligatory prayer for the dead is read, all present must stand. As there are no clergy in the Baha'i faith, an elected local spiritual assembly will often help the family with funeral arrangements. I have only conducted a few Jewish funerals. On the whole, the various synagogues handle their own funerals, and Jewish burial societies provide white shrouds and simple coffins. Because the origins of Jews in Britain go back to the 12th century, they have very strong social and religious structures in place. Many of the more recent ethnic communities in Britain don't. Like Islam and Baha'i, Orthodox Judaism doesn't allow cremation, because they believe in a physical resurrection of soul and body. One of the interesting rituals Orthodox Jews have is the tearing of a garment at the graveside. This is because bereavement is seen as something that can induce anger. So, Jewish thinking runs, it is better to take the anger out on a garment than another human being or God. Surprisingly, some of the old South London customs and superstitions surrounding death remain. Some people still put white sheets up in the windows after a death, the reason being that it is thought unlucky to have any reflections in a room where someone has died. Others will not have red and white flowers together, because red and white are equated with blood and bandages. And even today I have seen some children touch their collar when a cortege passes through Bermondsey. In the old days, the kids would sing, "Hold your collar, walla walla walla, never catch a fever." Today, while kids still hold their collar, they don't know the rhyme. My dad always used to say to me, "Barry, when you get to the cemetery, up you get with a brush. We don't want any petals falling off the hearse." This was because of the belief that a falling petal means there's another death to follow. But the old tradition of placing pennies over the eyes of a deceased person wasn't, as was thought, a payment for going from this world to the next. It was simply because pennies were heavy enough to keep the eyes closed. In the popular imagination, funeral homes are associated with the supernatural and seen as spooky places. In reality, they are very ordinary places. As in any profession, what most people would consider abnormal becomes normal to you. However, I must admit I have witnessed several strange incidents over the years. One time, a young man was brought to the funeral home after being killed in an accident. His body was in a terrible state, and his mouth was still open. I had just come back from New York, where I'd been learning new methods of embalming, and I was keen to try them out. His mother, a university teacher, came to see him the next day. As you might expect, she was heartbroken. For the next week, she came early every morning and would sit beside him until evening. When I walked past the Chapel of Rest, I would hear her inside talking to him softly. On the day before the funeral, she came out of the chapel and said to me, "He's very pleased, you know. He's very happy where he is. And he said that you helped him on his way." "Really?" I replied, unsure exactly what she meant. She nodded and told me she was a spiritualist. "He'd asked me to stay with him, but now he's told me I can go home, because he feels safe with you." Smiling, she then told me he'd laughed when I'd put his shoes on the wrong feet. She was right. I had got his shoes mixed up. But how did she know? "You've had to do something to his mouth," she continued. "But he was pleased you did it, because he knew I wouldn't have been happy to have seen him like he was when he came in." Then she told me in detail exactly what I had done to his mouth. No one in this country knew what this technique was, and there was no way she could have seen what I had done as it was concealed. I was astounded. How did she know this? When she died, 10 years later, I received instructions from her family that she was to be buried with her son. They gave me a letter she had written to me. In it, she thanked me for the care I gave her son and ended by saying that after her death, she would be my guardian angel. Knowing she is watching over me is reassuring and gives me faith in what I do. Fred Albin told me of how, in the old workshop at Jamaica Road, the atmosphere would go cold, the windows rattle, the fire in the stove would blow itself up again when the embers were about to die. It was, he said, a dreadful feeling. Nevertheless, one evening he decided to stay to try and find out what was behind all of this. He waited patiently for several hours. There was suddenly a loud bang, and doors began to open and close. He spoke to whatever was there and said that it couldn't remain. This was a place where other people came to pass on. From that moment, he never saw anything again. All the staff believe that my office at the funeral home in Culling Road is haunted. There's a coldness in it, even when the heating is on. A musky smell and a strange atmosphere. The door slams on its own, and sometimes the lock won't undo. Joanna, my receptionist, has seen an arm come through the door and slam it. Some days, when I've come in, I've noticed that the pieces on the chessboard have been in different positions, or pages in my diary have been turned over. In the 19th century, a workhouse stood on the land. Whether these occurrences have something to do with this, I don't know. But I never get frightened. I feel protected by the spirits who have passed through my funeral home. I see it as a place marked by goodness rather than evil. Apart from my office, the funeral home is, I have to say, very peaceful and serene. The case of the mysterious priest easily has to be the strangest thing I have ever experienced. I arrived with the funeral on a grey, cold afternoon at Nunhead Cemetery, expecting the service to be taken by Mr. Black, one of the rota ministers there, who always gave the same 5-minute service for everyone. But on this particular day, he was nowhere to be seen. All of a sudden, a priest appeared at the chapel door, wearing one of those Canterbury caps which were once popular with clergy in days gone by, and a long, heavy black cloak with a gold clasp. When I asked him who he was, he just nodded silently. He did the same when I introduced the family. He then walked slowly into the chapel. Sitting in the hearse while I waited for the service to finish, I remarked to my driver on the odd behaviour of the priest. The family eventually came out of the chapel and got into the cars to go to the grave. I was expecting the priest to do the same, but without saying anything, he set off along an old footpath. He stood solemnly at the graveside, then made the sign of the cross and muttered, "Et cum spiritu tuo," as the coffin was lowered. After this, he bowed his head, turned, walked away, and vanished into the bushes. As we were driving out of the cemetery, I stopped at the superintendent's office. "Who was that priest who just took the service?" I called through the window of the hearse. "What priest?" asked the superintendent. "The elderly man in the cap. The one who looked like Bela Lugosi in Dracula. He used Latin in the service." "The family didn't understand a word of it," I said. The superintendent shook his head and looked at me quizzically. "I don't know any priest who fits that description, Barry." "But we ordered a rota minister." "No, Barry. We didn't receive any instructions for a rota minister." I was baffled. And to this day, I still don't know who that priest was. Was he a man, or was he a ghost? These incidents all point to another dimension to life, the spiritual. The belief in a soul is common in many cultures and religions. For me, the body is a piece of apparatus. If the heart stops, for example, does it mean that is the end of the person? I don't believe it does. I believe that life goes on somewhere. It would be ridiculous to think that just because a tube breaks in a television, the program ends. It doesn't, of course. I believe in a soul, and that it leaves the body. Sometimes the soul or spirit doesn't know how to move on, and maybe they don't even know they are dead. Who really knows? I feel these strange experiences perhaps come from this. Death is the eternal mystery, the door through which kings, presidents, paupers, saints and sinners all have to pass. And it is frightening, even for someone who has faith. But I don't see it as the end, rather as a continuation or a new beginning. This reminds me of the time a local Jack the Lad character was lying in the chapel of rest, dressed in a flash suit with a dicky bow. Looking down at him, one of his friends shook his head and remarked, "He never believed in heaven, and he never believed in hell. And there he is, all dressed up and nowhere to go." It was a dark, cold, windy afternoon at Nunhead Cemetery. The occasion was the funeral of an elderly Bermondsey gentleman. He had, I think, been ill for some time, so his death had been expected. The only mourner in the stark chapel was his wife, a small, frail lady whose lined face spoke of hard work and sacrifice. After the rota minister had finished the short service, probably his third or fourth that day, she remained motionless in her seat in the front pews. Aware that another funeral party would be arriving within a few minutes, I walked over and gently placed my hand on her arm to lead her back to the limousine outside. "Come on, love. Shall we go?" She looked up at me with tears in her eyes and said, "Me and Billy, we've been together for..." And then she began to sing softly. 50 years, and it don't seem a day too long. As she sang the song the whole way through, I struggled hard to keep my composure, feeling I was going to cry in a minute. Looking at the tears running down her face, I felt so sad. Billy and she had been such a devoted couple, and now she was facing life alone. I knew what was going through her mind. How can I cope? Will I cope? He was my life. What kind of future faces me? As often happens in situations like this, she didn't live much longer. A few months later, I was helping to bear her coffin into the same chapel, knowing that she had what she wanted, to be reunited with her husband. And as I sat there at the back of the chapel, all I could hear was her sweet Cockney voice singing, "Me and Billy, we've been together for 50 years, and it don't seem a day too long." Although it wasn't recorded on her death certificate, what she really died of was a broken heart. That elderly lady had come face to face with one of the hardest challenges you encounter in life. How do you live without someone after they have died, leaving behind a huge emptiness in your life? When you have lost a loved one, it doesn't seem to matter what anyone says. People sometimes say, "I know how you feel," but of course they don't. If, for example, a parent loses a child, the first thing I say is, "I can't imagine how you feel. How could I, never having lost a child?" I first came face to face with the pain and darkness that the death of a loved one brings when my mother died. I was just 17 at the time, and even though I grew up in a funeral home, the finality of death hadn't really hit me. I had seen deceased persons, acted as a bearer at funerals, polished coffins, removed bodies to and from mortuaries, and yet death seemed to be something that happened to someone else. I came home from school one day to find that my mum was in bed. Dad told me she wasn't feeling well, and that the doctor was going to call to see her after the surgery closed. Mum had been burping a lot, he explained, and her tummy had swollen. Dr. Tay, the family doctor, examined her and suggested she went to see Mr. Woss, a surgeon at Guy's, who was also a friend of my dad. Mr. Woss recommended that Dad took her on holiday for a change of scenery. They flew to Italy for a fortnight, and I went to stay with my nan. But they cut short the holiday as Mum had got worse. She was immediately admitted to Guy's for some tests. Next morning, I was in the bathroom when I suddenly heard my nan give an anguished shout. Grabbing a towel, I leapt out of the bath and ran into the living room to see what was the matter. My dad was standing there, looking ashen-faced, and my nan was bent over the side of the armchair, sobbing. "What's happened?" He looked hard at me for a few seconds, and then burst into tears. "Barry, Mummy's died. She's dead, Barry. She died early this morning." I stood there, trying to take in the words, but I couldn't. "No, Dad, she can't be. You got it wrong." Then I began to shake. "No, she can't be. How can she be?" My dad shook his head and said weakly, "She is, son." To be told at 17 years of age that your mother has died is something you can't comprehend. You think your parents, like you, are going to live forever. My mum was just 43 and had been full of life.
I tried to let the words sink into me, but my mind was all over the place. All I could think was, how could she have died? It was impossible. She couldn't have. This must be a dream, or a mistake.
Dad and I then drove up to Guy's, both of us in tears. On the way, he told me that Mum had got up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet and had collapsed as a result of a blood clot. She'd had a massive stomach cancer. Reaching the ward, the first thing that struck me was that the curtain had been pulled round Mum's bed. I slipped through it and saw her lying motionless on the bed, her eyes open. I cuddled her. No, she couldn't be dead. She was just sleeping. My dad stood behind me, trying to control the tears.
Well, what do we do?
He asked, staring at the floor. I looked at him, but I didn't know what to say.
What do we do, son?
He repeated.
I don't know, Dad. I don't know.
So here were two people experienced in death and organizing funerals, and we didn't know what to do. Mum's death had paralyzed us both, and we couldn't think straight. This is, I have discovered over the years, one of the things the death of someone you love can do to you. It was a big funeral, with about 20 limousines making their way from the shop in Jamaica Road and down Abbey Street to St. Mary Magdalene Church at the end of Bermondsey Street. There wasn't a spare seat to be had. Sitting there were all my extended family, friends from school, Professor Keith Simpson, the Southwark coroner, the registrars, police officers, florists, Mr. Wass, the surgeon from Guy's, old Mr. Smith, a funeral director who had a shop in Borough, and two staff from Tadman's, a funeral firm with a shop off the Mile End Road. As I sat there through the service, staring at Mum's casket and the floral tributes that surrounded it, two things suddenly hit me for the first time. I never said goodbye to her, and she died alone. Tears flooded down my face when I realized this. As we walked out of the church, Ernie Albin squeezed my arm and whispered, "Barry, be strong. Be strong." Sadly, this was the last time I was to see him alive. He died a year later. The cortege made its way to Camberwell New Cemetery, where a plot had been reserved in what was called the Rosary Section, a beautiful floral area. As Mum's casket was lowered into the grave by Fred and the men, all I could think about was that I hadn't said goodbye and that she had died alone. There was so much I would have told her. Most important of all, I would have said how much I loved her, even though I had told her that many times during her life. And it suddenly dawned on me that, up until then, all the deaths I had been involved in hadn't touched me as real. But Mum's death was real, and I became aware of my own mortality. It chilled me to think that I wasn't going to live forever. When I trained as a bereavement counsellor, I realized that I had denied my mother's death inside of me. I had shut it off out of fear of what those feelings might do to me. The thousands of families I have conducted funerals for have taught me that the sooner you face bereavement, the quicker you can move your life on. When people say, "I'll never get over it," they are absolutely right. You never get over the death of someone you love dearly. Even though I am now 50, I have never got over the death of my mother. Murray E. Parks, the author of Stages of Grief, outlined four stages of grief: numbness, denial, deprivation, and depression. He was the first to refer to bereavement as an illness, and described grieving as a 13-month illness. The reason for this is that a person had to pass through all the first anniversaries associated with a loved one, Christmas, the birthday, holidays, and so on, before they could begin the process of recovery. My experience with bereaved families supports everything he said. It goes without saying that the way a person grieves is also shaped by their beliefs about what happens beyond death. Religion, of whatever variety, can provide enormous consolation. I've lost count of the times that someone has come up to me after a service or in a cemetery and said, "You know, I don't think I could have coped with this if it hadn't been for my faith in God." For the non-believer,
The death of a loved one is perhaps more difficult to face, because they have no faith in there being another life than this. No death can be harder to come to terms with than the death of a baby or a child. When I was a young man training to be a funeral director, the first jobs I was given were with children. At one time, some fetuses and stillbirths would not be buried individually, but placed in the same coffin as a pauper. This practice had stopped by the time I came into the funeral business, but I was still very aware of it. Once, when I was doing a removal from Guy's Hospital, a midwife asked if she could visit the funeral home because she'd never been to one before. So the following week I gave her a guided tour. When I asked her what happened to the dead fetuses, she had to admit that she didn't know. When I made some inquiries through Father Cooley, one of the Catholic chaplains at the hospital, I was shocked to discover that fetuses were disposed of with a clinical waste. Not long after, I was at a dinner party with some friends. We were talking and joking about local gossip, politics, football, all the usual things, when the conversation turned to babies. Everyone should know where someone they love is, if they have died. It's that important, I suggested. The wife of one of my friends went quiet and stared at me for a moment. I wondered if I had said something wrong and looked at her husband. He nodded at me awkwardly and then looked away. She said, "You're right, Barry. I lost a baby once. It was many years ago when I was in St. Olive's Hospital. And do you know, I don't know what happened to it. Years later, I felt I wanted to know what had happened, but when I contacted the hospital, no one was able to tell me." I listened silently as she talked about the pain she felt at not knowing the whereabouts of her baby. She said she wanted to know where the baby was, so that a couple of times a year she could visit the grave with a few flowers. This brought home to me not only how important it was to know where a loved one was buried, but also the importance of having a funeral for fetuses. When I proposed this to the management at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospitals, they all agreed it should be provided. When a hospital has a number of fetuses, they will phone me up and ask me to come and collect them from the mortuary. I put each fetus in a tiny white box about the size of a hand, and I take them away in a small carry cot. I do this because I believe each life is sacred, whether it's a one-day-old fetus or someone who is 100. The fetuses are brought to the funeral home and put in a refrigerator until the burial or cremation is arranged. They are all buried individually in one grave, or cremated. One of my staff will attend and say a short prayer, such as, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." The mother is always invited to attend. If she wants to come, we meet her at the cemetery or crematorium. At Honor Oak Crematorium, a baby's ashes are scattered on a stretch of lawn known as the baby's lawn, and we also have a baby section in our cremation cemetery. Every burial or cremation is recorded in a book, and every fetus has a memorial card printed for it. Over the last 4 or 5 years, I must have had approximately 50 people who have contacted us through the hospital wanting to know what happened to their baby. Sometimes this might be a year later, and I can tell them by finding the details in the book. They take great consolation from this. Cars have always been my passion. Ever since, at the age of 14, I first backed the old Rolls-Royces into the garage in Southwark Park Road. In fact, I can probably trace it back to when I used to run around in homemade carts. And after passing my driving test, my dad bought me a Ford Popular, which I soon exchanged for a Morris Traveller. Fred was a great wheeler dealer, and a bit of a specialist in cars, especially Rolls-Royces. He once bought a Rolls with a mother-of-pearl dashboard and a machine-gun turret on the back from a sheikh in Saudi Arabia. My 20-strong fleet includes 2 1932 Sister Simpson and Slater Rolls-Royce bodied hearses. I had tracked down the second one at Kendall's funeral directors in Dalston. Bringing it back to Albin's, where it had begun its life, was like bringing it home. I also own 2 luxury saloons, one convertible floral hearse, which is used in the summer to carry floral tributes in front of the horse-drawn hearse, a landau to accompany the horse-drawn hearse, 2 private ambulances, a Luton van for delivering coffins from our factory, a trailer,
a four-wheel drive jeep for towing the horse box, three vehicles for general use, and an air-cooled interior vehicle for long-distance removals. I also succeeded in purchasing the Queen Mother's Daimler. It cost me quite a bit, but it was worth it, for it now means that people in Bermondsey can travel in the car the Queen Mother used to travel in. I like the idea of that, and so does Bermondsey. F.A. Albin & Sons is one of around 3,500 funeral firms in the UK. However, the £1 billion-a-year industry has been undergoing major changes in the last 20 years. Along with the co-op, Service Corporation International, SCI, now conduct the funerals of a large percentage of the 680,000 deaths in the UK every year. While the name above the funeral home in your local high street might not have changed, behind the scenes, the approach to funerals has. SCI are the world's largest firm of funeral directors. From their head office in Sutton Coldfield, West Midlands, they now run 530 funeral homes, including those previously owned by Kenyans, 22 crematoria and 5 cemeteries. In an average year, they conduct 80,000 funerals. The kind of personal touch that independent family funeral directors can provide is illustrated by the case of a man in Bermondsey who comes to me every year on his birthday. We have drafted his will, as we often do, free of charge for people. He has asked me to be his executor, clear his flat, and not notify his brother until after the funeral. This one visit a year makes him feel very comfortable about his affairs. I'm a bit like social services. He hasn't paid me a penny yet. He trusts me so much. The fact that his will is locked away in our safe at Culling Road puts his mind at rest. And I'm so proud of this. Big companies, such as the Co-op or SCI, wouldn't and couldn't take this approach. And because of their size, they can't afford to. In 2000, I purchased Hitchcock's funeral directors in the East End. I did so because I wanted to save one of the few remaining old-style funeral businesses. Hitchcock's shopfront on Barking Road hadn't changed in 100 years, and the first entry recorded in their book, in copperplate writing, is dated 1898. When I went over to view it, it was like revisiting my childhood. The trapdoor to the cellar, the wardrobe lined with white calico to keep the dust off the clothes, the damp rooms upstairs, the chapel of rest out the back, the outside toilets. All of this was identical to Albin's former funeral home on Jamaica Road. The Hitchcock's business included the funeral home, stables, one limousine and a hearse. Russell, the owner of Hitchcock's, could probably have sold the business for a higher price to SCI, but he wanted to keep the family tradition alive and also stay and help us. That is why I'm keeping the name Hitchcock for 5 years. After then, I may rename it Albin and Hitchcock's. I see the purchase of Hitchcock's as the final piece of the jigsaw, and as something that will bring F.A. Albin & Sons up to its final capacity. With our shops in Bermondsey, Deptford, Mottingham and Barking Road, we have gone full circle, as at one time we had shops in Bermondsey, Lewisham, Downham and Leytonstone. All along I have tried gradually to bring the company up to date in the 20th century, while keeping the charm of the 19th. After buying the business, I was keen to reinstate horse-drawn funerals, which Albin's had ceased to do in the 1940s. So in the early 1990s, I travelled to Ireland to buy a horse-drawn hearse, which had ended up in an agricultural museum. Made in Birmingham by Marsden's in 1864 for use in Ireland, it had carried the coffin of Douglas Hyde, the first Irish president. We brought it to London on a trailer, stripped it and rewooded it, and Fred Albin did a marvellous job applying paint and gold leaf. As far as I'm aware, it is the biggest and heaviest horse-drawn hearse in the country. I also bought two fabulous black Frisian horses that came from the same farm in Belgium that the firm had bought horses from in the early 1900s. As I told the gentleman who phoned me from prison, I named the horses Fred and George, after Fred Albin and my dad. The first funeral they did was that of Debbie, a lovely local girl who was killed when a friend's Minnie overturned in Rotherhithe. Because her death really touched me, I attached a plate to the hearse to mark the event. Although I'm not what you would call a horsey type, my wish before I retire is to ride one of the horses at the head of the cortege.
My initial introduction to the American funeral industry came in my late 20s and early 30s, when I undertook a number of courses at Campbell's Funeral Home College in Manhattan, New York. It wasn't until I became involved with Airline Mortuary Services, AMS, that I really got to know America and how the funeral industry operates there. When I met John Bumbau, their head of operations, at a conference in Eastbourne in 1988, I told him about my idea for streamlining the cost of shipping human remains, sometimes known as horizontal passengers. Back then, different countries charged different rates to transport human remains, and the United States had different rates for different parts of the country. It occurred to me that it would be much easier and less confusing to have a fixed rate throughout the USA. That way you'd be able to tell the family exactly how much it would cost without depending on the weight of the coffin or having to make phone calls to various airlines. When I explained my idea to John, he thought it sounded very workable and invited me to visit AMS in Houston, Texas. I think he was also impressed by the fact that Albins had recently been accepted onto the list of preferential funeral directors at the American Embassy in London, and I had begun to transport deceased persons to the States. A few weeks later, I flew to Houston, feeling quite excited at the prospect of working for AMS. The company was located on the 8th floor of a modern building in a busy street amidst the skyscrapers that are the hallmark of the city, just a few miles from the American headquarters of SCI. Sitting in a lively Mexican bar in downtown Houston one evening, I pointed out to John that the shipping of human remains from Europe to the US was not coordinated. I suggested keeping a supply of wooden air trays, similar to pallets, at key airports, and channeling business there. This way, we would make some money, and European funeral directors would find shipping remains to the US a lot easier. Your average funeral director in Europe would only ship one or two human remains to the US each year, and they are unfamiliar with the procedures, rates, types of coffins required, and airline timetables. John agreed that there was a golden business opportunity here, and having worked with Turner's Air Freight Agency, I had the necessary experience to take on the job. I enjoyed my few days in Houston, and I got on very well with Carol Bearden, the office manager at AMS. We have been fantastic friends ever since. She opened many doors for me when I travelled around America. 6 weeks later, I returned for further business discussions with AMS, and a month later, to my delight, I was awarded the European agency. I immediately placed adverts in funeral industry journals, and it wasn't long before Albins had signed up funeral directors in the UK, Ireland, France, Italy, and Spain. Once I had been awarded the European agency, I began to make regular business trips to AMS. One evening, after a meal in my hotel in Newark, where I was spending a night before flying to Houston, I was getting into the bath when I was gripped by a searing pain. I'd never experienced anything like it in my life. Panicking, I rang Carol, who was in her room, and before long I was lying on a stretcher with an oxygen mask over my face and being lifted into the back of an ambulance. The next thing I remember was being pushed through the swing doors of a charity hospital and then left in a shabby, smelly corridor. The scene around me was chaotic. Doctors and nurses were rushing about, and people were screaming and shouting, while two burly armed security guards were wrestling a youth to the floor by the coffee machine. I noticed the man on the trolley next to me was handcuffed. Another man was bleeding from what looked like gunshot wounds. My pain was worse than ever, and I could feel everything becoming a blur. I called out for one of the nurses to help me, but she muttered something and carried on past me. I called to another nurse. "Stay there," she snapped back. "Wait your turn." "But I'm in agony," I cried. "Why won't you help me?" "Wait your turn, I told you," she repeated tersely, and disappeared into a room. For the first time in my life, I felt that I was dying. The pain was so bad. I could see my life disappearing in front of me. Was this it? Having stared at death in so many faces, on so many occasions, I felt I was now on the verge of my own death. I would become the body on the mortuary table, the most famous person in the world for a day. After lying on the trolley for 12 hours, listening to people shouting and swearing, I was wheeled down the corridor through a set of swing doors and into a ward. A stressed-looking young doctor appeared at my side, bristly examined me, gave me an MRI scan, and then told me I had a kidney stone.
but would be fine. He gave me an injection of morphine, and I was sent on my way with a prescription for some tablets and the instruction to drink plenty of water and see a specialist. With great relief, I climbed into a cab outside the hospital and headed back across the city to my hotel. On reflection, I was in more danger from the hospital than from my kidney stone. Every time I returned from the States, I had a new idea to improve Albin's. My staff used to find this amusing. "What is it this time?" they would laugh when I arrived bubbling with enthusiasm on a Monday morning. One year, I returned with a canopy to cover areas around the graveside to keep people dry. On another occasion, I brought back a coffin-lowering machine. I bought an organ that plays itself, chair covers with the name F.A. Albin embroidered on them, and pendant jewellery, which people could buy and keep a lock of hair or ashes in. Leafing through some of the documents one day about the Dyers, distant relations of my father, who ran a funeral business in Walthamstow, I was astonished to read that Arthur Dyer visited America in the 1920s and came back with many good ideas. It was while on my travels in America that I first came across something called cryonics. With its aim of freezing people at death and then one day bringing them back to life, it sounded bizarre and straight out of science fiction. Little did I know that I would end up becoming their European agent. I rang the doorbell of a rather drab-looking building in a poor area of Detroit and waited. Dressed in my best suit, I felt out of place, especially when I noticed a group of dubious-looking youths across the road, eyeing me suspiciously. I stood there for what seemed to be a long time, and then rang the bell again. After a while, I heard the muffled sound of footsteps, and then the small hatch in the door opened. An eye appeared, and a deep voice said, "Yeah." This was bizarre, I thought, as images flitted through my mind of Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein. I said to the eye, "I'm Mr. Albin from London."
"Stand back from the door, please."
I heard the sound of bolts being undone, and eventually the door slowly creaked open. Standing there was a small, round-shouldered man, clad in a white coat with a collar rolled up to his neck and wearing thick-soled Dr. Martin boots. He had a very serious-looking face and large ears. I couldn't help but think that he looked as if he'd stepped off the film set for one of those old black-and-white horror films.
"Walk this way," he said, leading me down a dark corridor, his feet dragging along the floor.
"I'd better not. I'll get arrested," I thought to myself. It was the summer of 1993, and I was visiting the famous and infamous Cryonics Institute, founded by Dr. Robert Ettinger, regarded as the father of the cryonics movement. In his two books from the 1960s, The Prospect of Immortality and Man into Superman, he argued that dying patients could be frozen until medical technology was advanced enough to deal with their illnesses. In 1967, he set up the Immortalist Society, which later became the Cryonics Institute, the year that James Bedford became the first person to be cryonically suspended. Ettinger and other cryonicists believe that death is not the absolute end, but rather medical science's inability to keep a patient alive. "People will be thawed out and brought back to life," claim the cryonicists, "when scientific progress has reached a certain point, whenever that is." To support their optimistic view of science, they will point to kidney and heart transplants, frozen embryos, and now cloning, and say that years ago these developments would have been thought impossible. I had first become interested in cryonics when I heard about it through my work for AMS, but I never for a minute imagined that I'd become the sole European licensed agent for the Cryonics Institute. However, after giving a lecture about the difference between the American and British funeral industries at a conference in Baltimore, I was approached by a tall, bearded man who congratulated me on my knowledge of the subject. It turned out he was a client of the Cryonics Institute in Detroit, and he was looking for someone to take care of some of his friends in Europe, who, upon death, would need perfusion, a method similar to embalming, before they were flown to Detroit. He asked me if I was interested in doing the work, and, always looking to improve the range of services I offer to families, I said yes. So here I was in America's Midwest, following this man down the poorly lit corridor of a bizarre institute. All sorts of questions were running through my mind.
What sort of place was this? What did I really think about cryonics? Would it really be possible to bring people back to life? What was I getting myself into? When we passed the open door to a room full of large fiberglass capsules, I stopped in amazement. Around 8 feet high, they resembled vats in a brewery, I thought. The man led me into the room. "These are the cryostats, where we keep our patients," he said with a wave of his hand. "This is Mr. Edinger's first wife. Here is Mr. Edinger's mother-in-law." Then, pointing to a capsule at the far end, he said, "And this is Mr. Edinger's dog." "What are those two capsules for?" I asked my guide, pointing to two empty ones in the corner of the room. "Those are for Edinger and Edinger's new wife," the little man croaked, looking up at me. The thought of Mr. Edinger ending up between his two wives and a mother-in-law struck me as very amusing. It would be quite a reunion. As we continued the tour, I discovered that people who have been cryonically suspended are known as patients, not deceased persons. After arriving at the Institute, they are eventually frozen to minus 196 degrees centigrade, the point when physical decay ceases, and placed upside down, so that if any problems develop, such as thawing, only the feet will be damaged, in a cryostat or capsule filled with liquid nitrogen. The cryostats are alarmed, and their temperature is checked daily. Electricity generators are in place in case there's a power cut. I was later taken to a local funeral home run by Sally Bazan, who is registered with the Cryonics Institute to remove and perfuse their deceased members. Here I had to attend an embalming to prove that I was competent. They must have been happy with my knowledge of embalming, for a week after I arrived back in London, I received a letter confirming my appointment as the European agent for the Cryonics Institute. As I read it, I wondered if I would be able to do my first cryonics case correctly. My job is not to freeze the body, but to cool it down and keep it at around 0 degrees centigrade, a temperature at which it must be able to remain for around 40 hours, more than enough time to fly anyone from Europe to Detroit. But no matter how much preparation you do in life, things can still go wrong. Other questions surfaced. How would I feel about it? Would the body arrive in Detroit in the right condition? Had I made the right decision in taking on this European agency? It turned out to be 3 years before I was to find out. One day in June 1996, the phone rang, and a heavily accented voice at the other end said, "This is Mr. Muller. Is that Albin?" It wasn't uncommon for me to be called simply Albin. The staff at the Iranian embassy always refer to me in that way. "Yes, speaking. How can I help you, Mr. Muller?" Mr. Muller lived in Essen, Germany, and a few months before had visited me to sign his elderly mother up with the Cryonics Institute. Small, with bulging eyes, thick rubbery lips, he had seemed a little bit eccentric. Many people who enter a funeral home feel a mixture of awkwardness and discomfort due to being in a place which they associate purely with death. But Mr. Muller was like a child in a toy shop when he had visited the funeral home. He made me show him the mortuary, chapels of rest, and a selection of coffins and caskets. Now on the phone, he said,
"It's my mother."
"I'm very sorry, Mr. Muller. When did she die?"
"No, no, she's not dead yet. But I'd like you to send someone out here to get things ready," he said.
Then added solemnly, "It won't be long, Albin." "Very well, Mr. Muller," I replied, somewhat surprised. Without thinking, I found myself answering, "I'll send one of my experienced staff."
"Good. Phone me when you have arranged the travel details," he said, and put the phone down.
As this was my first cryonics case, I figured that it was, after all, probably wise to send one of my team to check things out. I asked Rose, one of my longest-serving staff members, to fly out on the Thursday, stay overnight in a hotel, and return the next day. She was thrilled at the prospect of a spot of overseas travel and quite fascinated by cryonics. On Friday afternoon, Rose returned from her visit to Essen. As soon as she walked into the funeral home, I could tell from her face that something was wrong. "How was it, Rose?"
"Oh, Barry, it was awful. It was like something out of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Boy, am I glad to be back."
We crowded around Rose to hear all the details. She said that Mr. Muller was one of the weirdest people she had ever met, and that he kept insisting she stayed at his house, a creepy place if ever she saw one. His mother, who was confined to bed, did indeed appear to be very ill. Rose admitted she was petrified when Mr. Muller took her down into the cellar to show her the table and a bath where the perfusion would take place. About 3 weeks later, Mr. Muller phoned me again. I thought his mother must now have passed away. He told me she hadn't, but he wanted me to go out to Essen. "But your mother might live for many months, even years yet," I said. "I run a business. I can't sit out in Germany waiting for her to die, Mr. Muller. Rose has already been over to see you. Don't worry. When the time comes, everything will be fine."
"Albin, no! You must come," he insisted, getting a little irate.
"As soon as your mother passes away, contact me, and I will be there as quickly as I can," I replied, determined to stand my ground. He put the phone down and seemed to accept this, albeit reluctantly. But I was wrong. Every day for the next month, Mr. Muller phoned to try and persuade me to go to Essen. But I repeatedly told him there was no point until she had actually died. Then one morning, Mr. Muller phoned me to say, yes, his mother had passed away.
"How long will it take you to get here? 1 hour? 2 hours?" he asked urgently. "How long?"
"I'm in London, Mr. Muller," I reminded him. "I can't just hop on a bus. I'll be there as quickly as I can," I said, reminding him to keep his mother in a cool place and pack ice around her head. Knowing that Mr. Muller's mother was close to death, I had made arrangements in advance. I had found a firm of funeral directors in Essen who had agreed to take her body to Dusseldorf Airport for transportation to Detroit. I had sent them a specially made casket lined with polystyrene to help it retain the temperature of the ice. They had assured me they would keep the mortuary extra cool and have the necessary amount of packed ice available. I had made travel plans in advance as well. Cliff, my embalmer, would be travelling with me, and also my eldest son, Simon. I had found a small airfield in Essex, where I could charter a light aircraft to Germany at short notice. The reason for speed is that to carry out cryonic suspension, you have to cool down the body as quickly as possible, in order to keep the brain cells from dying. Having phoned the airfield to tell them we were on our way, we put our protective suits, embalming equipment, and a change of clothes in the car and headed off towards Essex. A few hours later, we touched down at Essen Airport. Mr. Muller had said he would be there to meet us. Cliff, Simon, and I stood in the arrivals area and waited. They were curious to meet this man, who had become a bit of a living legend amongst the staff at the funeral home, but he was nowhere to be seen. After about half an hour, I decided that we should get a taxi to his house, which was in a suburb in the north of the town. As we drove towards the centre of town, I was beginning to get apprehensive. After all Mr. Muller's phone calls and pleas for me to come over, it was a little unsettling that he hadn't turned up to meet us as arranged. The taxi turned into a long street of large, grey, three-storey houses and stopped halfway along. There he was, dressed in an ill-fitting suit, coming out of his house. "Mr. Muller, how are you? We were expecting you to meet us at the airport," I said, walking towards him. But I couldn't believe it. He just walked right past me. "Mr. Muller," I called after him. "It's Barry. I'm here to take care of your mother." He stopped and slowly turned around.
"Ah, yes, Albin. Go inside, Albin," he said absent-mindedly,
motioning us towards the house. And then he continued off down the street. Puzzled, Cliff, Simon, and I walked through the open door into the house. Rose was right. It was a gloomy place, with a musty smell and full of heavy furniture, hundreds of books piled to the ceiling, glass cases containing stuffed fish and birds, and rather drab-looking prints of flowers and rural scenes on the wall. As we sat in the living room and waited for Mr. Muller's return, I could well understand Rose's reluctance to spend the night there.
"I've got a funny feeling about this," I said to Cliff.
"So have I, Barry."
After about half an hour, Mr. Muller casually strolled in. Without any explanation about where he had been or why he hadn't turned up at the airport, he impatiently ordered us to follow him. He opened a door and began descending the steep wooden steps into the darkness of the cellar.
"Where is she, Mr. Muller?" I asked, looking at various bits of junk scattered around. It was damp and hung with cobwebs. A single light bulb provided the only light. "Hofer's there," gestured Mr. Muller, matter-of-factly. I turned around and saw that he was pointing at a small food freezer. "No, surely not," I thought to myself. "He hasn't, has he?" But he had. He opened the lid and stood back to make way for Cliff and I. We peered inside, and there, bent double, was the body of a small elderly woman. I was astonished. When I had instructed Mr. Muller to pack his mother's head in ice, I hadn't anticipated that he would end up popping her into a food freezer. At least there wasn't any food inside it, I mused.
"Right, off you go then," ordered Mr. Muller, clapping his hands, as though this was the most normal thing in the world. And with that, he went back upstairs.
We looked at each other for a minute in disbelief, and then got on with the job. Donning our protective suits, we lifted the lady out of the freezer and placed her on a table. My first task, using a pair of surgical scissors, was to open an artery and vein in the neck and make small incisions in each, so that the deceased was ready for perfusion. Mr. Muller then returned. What was this? Surely not. He was clutching a video camera. Now I'd seen it all.
"Ignore me, Elbin," he muttered, fiddling with the camera.
If only I could, I thought, as I slid in a vein tube, a long, thin instrument to open up a vein. I then attached a tube from the vein to a jar. I put a tube from a pump in the artery. This makes the pump a substitute for the heart. The pump pushes saline and then glycerine and rose water into the arteries and washes the deoxygenated blood out through the vein drain. Another fluid, heparin, is used to clear any blood clots and thin the blood. "Are you sure you want to be here, sir?" I asked.
"Oh, yeah, yeah,"
he replied enthusiastically. Throughout my work, Mr. Muller stood pointing the camera over my shoulder, asking me every couple of minutes what I was doing. When I told him, he would say,
"Yeah, it's good,"
and repeat my words back to me in the manner of a running commentary. But I couldn't understand why he wanted to watch his mother being perfused. I wouldn't want to watch it being done to someone I loved. Then suddenly he would remember that it was his mother lying there and burst into tears before returning to his role as commentator.
"Excellent, Elbin. What are you doing now, Elbin?"
While trying to concentrate, Cliff, Simon and I had to fight back tears of laughter. This was even funnier, or sadder, than the time Dr. Jones stuck the thermometer up the backside of the man who had been washed up at Blackfriars Pier. The perfusion took about 4 hours, and, surprisingly, wasn't that difficult. My homework had paid off. In fact, Cliff and I agreed that we had both carried out straightforward embalmings that were more difficult. Mr. Muller seemed very excited.
"More fluid. Ah, mummy look wonderful, Elbin. You've done a good job. What do you think, eh? Very good, very good. Mummy, she live forever. Yeah, yeah."
"Only God knows about that," I responded. Two men from the local funeral directors arrived within half an hour. Despite the somewhat unusual nature of the removal, they seemed to take it in their stride, though I could see from the looks on their faces that they thought Mr. Muller a rather strange character. They placed his mother in a body bag, lifted her onto a stretcher, and carried her out to the van. Cliff, Simon and I said our goodbyes, told Mr. Muller not to worry, and got into the car the local funeral director had sent. His mother would be in her capsule in Detroit within 48 hours.
"Are you sure, Elbin? The ice no smelt?"
he asked with concern. "No, Mr. Muller, you have nothing to worry about. Now, I think we'd better go." Before we did, he made us stand there while he walked around us with his camera. As we were about to move off, Mr. Muller came running out of the house. What could be the matter now, I wondered, winding down the window.
"You know, Rose, she like mummy," he said. "Tell her she is welcome to stay here if ever she comes to Germany."
He was a kind man, really. "I will, Mr. Muller," I replied, trying to keep a straight face. "I'm sure she will be most grateful for the offer." Once at the funeral home, Mr. Muller's mother was taken into the mortuary. Here she was placed in a specially made container with polystyrene and ice inside, which I had shipped out in advance. Our primary task was to cool her head down. Fortunately, the local funeral directors had provided the 10 bags of ice I had requested.
"Dad," said Simon, "guess what?"
"What?" I replied, preoccupied with breaking the ice into small pieces with a hammer.
"Look over there."
I looked up, and who was standing in the doorway?
"Ah, Mr. Muller, fancy seeing you here." "How's it going, Elbin?" he said, pointing his camera at me. "I come to see Mummy packed in ice."
"Fine. But I think it's better if you go home now. We have to work very quickly to get your mother on that flight tonight."
"Mummy very cold now. Elbin, he make her very safe in ice."
"That's right, Mr. Muller. Now, we've got to keep working." Despite his somewhat eccentric manner, there was something endearing about him. He was a sincere man who only wanted what he thought was best for his mother. He nodded and backed away, still pointing his camera. Reaching the door, he said,
"Elbin, Mummy live forever? Elbin, well done."
After packing the coffin with ice, it was hermetically sealed and driven to the cargo section at Dortmund Airport for a flight that evening to New York. Once there, she would be transferred to a flight to Detroit, where staff from the Cryonics Institute would be waiting. A few weeks after my encounter with Mr. Muller, a letter arrived from the Cryonics Institute congratulating me on successfully carrying out the perfusion and the transportation from Essen to Detroit. Everything had been fine. It's always nice to be told you've done a good job. The final paragraph of the letter added that Mr. Muller had turned up unannounced at the Institute to see his mother. I had to smile to myself reading this, and I could picture the scene as Mr. Muller clambered up the ladder on the side of the capsule to look inside to make sure his mother was there. Did he have his video camera with him? Oh, I bet he did. Because cryonics sounds far-fetched and straight out of science fiction, people are fascinated by it. I've lost count of the number of times I've given radio or TV interviews about being the only funeral director in Europe involved in cryonics. I'm sure that producers and researchers have logged me down in their contact books as Barry Albin, the cryonic man. Woody Allen is said to be a cryonicist. He once reportedly said, "I don't want to live on in my work or my films. I want to live on in my apartment." I don't know if it's true that Michael Jackson has signed up, as some say, or whether Walt Disney has been cryonically suspended. But there is a man in Italy who has signed up to have his cat suspended. And there is an English family who have all signed up. At school, the son is known as Ice Pop. So far, no one in the UK has been cryonically suspended. Cryonics, of course, is man's battle to overcome death and gain eternal life, or at least an extended life. Our deepest desire is not to die, because death, the door to the unknown, frightens us. On the other side will either be eternal life, in some form, or oblivion. But if the brave new world of cryonics ever does come about, you don't know what kind of world you might return to. Imagine if you woke up and found yourself living in a Nazi-style dictatorship, for example. I, for one, wouldn't fancy that. Cryonicists, on the other hand, argue that it would be wonderful if great figures such as St. Paul, Plato, Shakespeare, or Beethoven had been suspended. Then, one day, they might have been able to return to the world and continue to enrich it. Some people, however, are understandably disturbed by cryonics. I remember an argument I once had with a Catholic priest. When he accused me of playing around with life and death, I pointed out that I was simply preparing the dead. I told him I believed that only God could give life and take it away, and if you had faith, then why should cryonics be a problem? In fact, a Catholic priest, with permission from his bishop, consecrated one of the cryostats. Some cryonicists argue that if a person is suffering from something such as cancer or Alzheimer's, and you kill them by a lethal injection, they can then be returned to life at a later date in good health. I cannot share this view that cryonics offers a solution to all the suffering in the world, nor would I want to play God.
even though roadside advertising hoardings in Italy once carried my photo with the words, "This man can help you live forever." In my view, suffering will always be a part of the human condition, and what's more, we will only return to life at the resurrection. So, why am I involved in cryonics if I don't believe in it? And doesn't cryonics clash with my Catholic beliefs? Ever since I conducted my first funeral of that West Indian child in Brixton, when I realized that what was important was what the family wanted, I have always believed that one of the most important tasks for a funeral director is to provide people with choice, whether to be embalmed or not, when they can visit the Chapel of Rest, the choice of a particular coffin or casket, a Rolls-Royce hearse or a horse-drawn hearse, the day and time of the funeral service, the hymns or songs they wish to be sung, the kind of floral tributes, the cemetery or crematorium, the type of headstone and inscription, and so on. And that's why I became involved in cryonics, because it gives people more choice about what happens to them after death. You might think that I do it for the money. I don't. I haven't made any money from cryonics, although I admit the publicity I've received has raised the profile of the firm. If a person wants to be cryonically suspended, have a woodland burial, have their ashes scattered at sea or over Tower Bridge, be mummified, there's an organisation in Salt Lake City that offers this. Attached to a satellite and sent into space, or placed inside a cryostat, then that's fine by me. I need to be able to offer every way of disposing of the dead. My role as a funeral director is not to judge people, but to undertake to care for the dead and for the living. Who knows? In 100 years from now, cryonics might be just another option for laying the dead to rest. At the time of writing, I'm in the middle of buying a cemetery in southeast London. If I am successful, I plan to open a British branch of the Cryonics Institute behind its mausoleum. To me, this makes sense. It will be far easier to carry out cryonic suspensions in London for European clients rather than ship them all the way to America. Do you remember what I said about counting those marbles? So then, have you thought about your funeral? Would you like it on a Saturday morning? What music would you like played? Would you like the horses, an Italian coffin, or an urn in my cremation cemetery? Or do you want to be cryonically suspended? I know I don't want to be, unless the cryonicists are proved right. Then we will all have to revise our thinking about life and death. No, when I die, I want to be buried in my old Rolls hearse in the yard of my funeral home, perhaps with a periscope, so that I can see what's going on.